Thanks for listening to WRIF Online. The live web stream will begin in 15 seconds.
Need office supplies? At OfficeStar247.com, you can compare their prices to the national stores. OfficeStar247.com has lower prices, free delivery, and no minimum order charges. OfficeStar247.com. They compare, you save.
Pause, mama, I'm sure all the hand and I get around. So mama, I'm sure all the henna now just around.
To the award-winning Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Well, thank you very much, and welcome to the broadcast. Another Sunday in Detroit. We're broadcasting all across America, all across the world, but primarily into the WRIF listening zone. That's how we call it. Jalene Jordan, welcome as usual. Jalene is my on-air producer and co-host. How are you?
I'm doing great.
What do we say?
Area.
Area. Broadcast area.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Wouldn't you say?
That was one of those tough words.
Hey, let's give a shout out to Slayer Allen. In there.
Yeah. Yeah. He does so much for this broadcast.
He's the one you talk to when you call 313-298-WRIF.
Do you know what that is? Have you memorized that?
No, you have.
No, I haven't. I'm reading it. 313-298-9743. I've only been doing it for a few years. But we're a phone-in talk show, so we'd like to hear from you and any of the issues revolving around your brain. We've got a lot. We prepared. So you may have to just kind of lay back for a minute and hear what we bring to the table. Or although you can, you can launch right now. 313-298-WRIF. If you either can't get through or you're a little bashful, you can write us at talkyes@yahoo.com. My personal website, having absolutely nothing to do with WRIF, and they're not making me say that, but I'm sure they're pleased that I am, is, I don't know. I mean, this is such a supportive management.
Some people might be pleased.
Yeah.
But they're not in management.
No, the management are the absolute best. I know people can't imagine me complimenting a management. Actually, they're all listening. That's why I'm saying this. Just, what do they call it, brown nosing.
No, it's true, though.
It is true. They are the greatest.
And I've worked for quite a few radio companies.
Yeah.
You have one?
One? No. Oh, no, no. Tons of them that have bought WRIF time and time again. The worst, the absolute worst management shall go unnamed. That's where Jalene and I worked together as a nationally syndicated show. But if you
tried our patience.
Phew, man, they were crazy, weren't they?
Oh, yeah.
Usually at this time, we say that Night Call is brought to you this hour by Waking Up, Metro Detroit Sweatshop Free Clothing Store. But you don't know this, do you?
I do know this.
You did, yeah. Things have kind of the bottoms falling out of Universal Mall, where the Waking Up store is at 12 Mile Road in DeQuinder. And Mike and Denise Kitchen are having to kind of re-examine the whole project. Probably means they're going to be out of there, the Universal Mall. I mean, wondering what with that mall, which has always looked like the ghost mall.
I've been there once, yeah. And I couldn't believe it.
But it's pretty sharp where the Waking Up store is. And they're still there. They're going to be there for a while. Maybe, Mike, you can email me because I know you and Denise often listen to the show. But I just wanted to give a shout-out to these people for not for sponsoring this show. Really, I mean, appreciate that for sure. But for doing what they're doing, for having the sweatshop-free clothing store, for selling the kind of publications they do, and fair trade coffee and chocolate and stuff like that. So they're going to be there. They're going to be there. You can go to wakingupstore.com. Yes. Wakingupstore.com.
But maybe they'll find another cool location.
Right? Well, they're talking about that. I got an email from Mike, and he said they're going to look in places like Ferndale. And
with Rock Mike.
But we will talk a little about the economy, and it's getting scarier and scarier, isn't it?
Well, yeah. The news is worse every week. And are you talking about the housing?
The housing, yeah. I want to talk about that a little later. Okay. But I forgot to say, this is the only program that dares to say that we support bong hits for Jesus.
I saw this story. And go figure. Okay, so basically the story is this young high school kid made a banner, and it said bong hits for Jesus. And what it was at a big event.
It was like 5 years ago. No, the event was, it was in Anchorage, I believe.
Yeah.
And he was a high school student, and the Olympic torch was coming through Anchorage.
That's what it was.
So he and his pals put up this 14-foot banner that said bong hits for Jesus, and he got tossed out of school because they said that he violated the anti-drug policy of the school. So what does bong hits for Jesus mean? It means absolutely nothing. It's an absurdist remark. And the young man said he had done it for laughs and to get on TV.
Well, he not only got on TV, he is now in the Supreme Court. And go figure who the prosecutor on this case is.
The guy, he must be, is he working for the...
I'm not sure about that.
I'm sorry, it was Juneau. Juneau, Alaska.
Kenneth Starr.
Star Inquisitor himself.
The one who went after Clinton.
Yeah, right. And spent, what was it, $35 million.
Oh, yeah.
Now, why isn't to find out whether he lied or not about, what was that, Whitewater and Monica Lewinsky?
Yeah.
And how much are we spending now to find out whether this the Bush Incorporated mob, have lied about everything? Zero. What's up with that?
Yeah. That's just all wrong.
Hey, you and why am I blanking on your husband's name? Can you say it? I can't say my wife's name on the air. I'm forbidden.
I don't know. I don't know.
Your husband.
I've never really asked, yeah.
Why am I? I'll think. I can't even think of it, but never mind.
That man I cohabitate with.
You man you cohabitate with. You watched the John Lennon movie.
Yeah, the U.S. versus John Lennon, the documentary.
What'd you think?
Oh, I loved it. Yeah. I mean, there was so much footage of the protests during the Vietnam era, and, you know, of course, which makes me weep, and proud to be doing that kind of thing here,
and
sad to be doing, having to do this kind of thing, and, you know, having to go to Washington because of what's going on in Iraq. But got to see a lot of, you know, John Sinclair, and got to see that concert you were at in 1971 in Ann Arbor. I was looking for you.
That's why Mom and Dad took me, because I was only four.
You had cool parents.
They were cool.
But I suggest that everyone sees this.
Yeah.
Especially if you're a John Lennon fan. He was more amazing after seeing this than I ever imagined.
I was very impressed with him. Yeah. So it's called the U.S. U.S. versus John Lennon. Okay. That is not the definite article. Now, I got an email from the Upland Hills Ecological Awareness Center out in, what is it, Oxford, I think? And they're going to be showing this film quite a ways from now, June 2nd, a Saturday at 7 p.m. I'll put you on the spot on the air, Jolene. I think we ought to host it if they want us.
Only if they want us.
Yeah. All right. So check that out. Well, I, speaking about demonstrations, I went to welcome Karl Rove, Bush's brain.
Peter, and I was here checking out the competition for the Riff Rock Girl contest. I had my priorities kind of all messed up, but I was supporting my team because I am a rock and roll DJ here.
I want to just give a shout out to Bruce and Jane and Dan who put this together, particularly Bruce and Jane. Dan sent me terrific photographs, which are now on my website, peterwerby.com.
How was it?
W-E-R-B-E, in case you're wondering about the spelling. Well, it was great. There was about 100 people there. Of course, the media said there was about 50. I mean, I personally counted.
Really? Yeah. You caught them red-handed.
Yeah. And it was two things that were extraordinary. One, I couldn't believe that the Republicans, in fact, Brian Dickerson, who's a columnist for the Detroit Free Press, he said, what were they thinking? I mean, here's Karl Rove, the presidential assistant, who has been implicated in so many felonious activities and backed the most awful policies of the Bush mob. And the Republicans, who already look bad to almost everybody, they bring in this guy that's always about a couple sentences away from being indicted.
Yeah, right.
Right.
So, he not only backed all of that, he created.
Sure. And one of the things, you know, this whole thing with the prosecutors being fired, there's a number of reasons that he did it. But one of the big ones was, is that they're always trying to you know, suppress the Democratic Party vote. And so,
really?
Yeah, so they wanted, yeah, they wanted these prosecutors in there that wouldn't do the normal prosecutorial stuff, but rather would concentrate on prosecuting Democrats that they alleged had carried out voter fraud. And they obviously hadn't. So they got rid of these. They got rid of folks that were trying to indict Republicans for corruption, which there's so much of it, and so many more are probably going to be indicted. And also to get like at one, I think it was in Arkansas. Yeah, in Arkansas, that they put in a Rove protege, and they took out these Republican prosecutors who had this great record, including one in Western Michigan. And so here we have the Oakland County Republicans. They refer to Karl Rove as the Honorable Karl Rove. Now, when you call somebody honorable, that's an honorific title that's almost always exclusively used for elected officials and primarily judges. So to call somebody honorable, particularly someone who has been part of shredding the Constitution, that is so disgraceful, and even from the Republican point of view, has given them such a black eye that the Republicans would invite him out to West Bloomfield at the Shenandoah Country Club to speak. Now, who introduces him? Sheriff Bouchard. I mean, you can maybe understand that because Bouchard's an elected Republican official, but isn't Sheriff Bouchard supposed to be enforcing law?
Yeah, I mean, that's true.
Why doesn't he arrest Karl Rove? And also, you know who introduced him? This is really shocking. The weatherman for Channel 4 WDIV, Chuck Gatica.
Wow.
What is up with that?
Listen, I'm a Rexy girl all the way, Dave Rexroth.
What the hell is that?
Channel 7. He's the meteorologist.
Never saw him.
Oh, he's fabulous. I used to work with him in television back in Iowa.
Really?
Yeah.
Well,
go Rexy.
Anyway. So
we like you even more now.
Chuck Gatica, my union brother, introduces.
Right.
You know, if someone said, I can't, I mean, for instance, if someone would have said to me, I don't know, I'm trying to think of an example. I was going to say if somebody would have asked me that I want to introduce Clinton. Hey, Al, now that you're in here, do you have anything up on the screen?
There's computer problems.
Oh, there's a computer problem.
Yeah.
There is a computer problem.
Answer phones.
Okay, so you can call in at 313-298-WRIF, but I'm going to ask you. I'm going to ask you who you are. Anyway, Bruce and Jane particularly, and I didn't meet Dan, but Dan sent me some great photos, and some of them were from Bruce and Jane. Oh, yeah. So the two things that were interesting about that, besides just hanging out with the signs in front of this criminal speaking at this country club. And so we're protesting there, and they're all driving up in their Jags and their Mercedes and their Cadillac. And every one of them laughed.
At all of you?
Well, I mean, he didn't laugh disparagingly, not like, ha, 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 what a pack of fools, not
right.
Like that, although they probably thought we were. It was, I think it was just sort of, they sort of have loss of affect anyways, inappropriate affect. You know, they respond in a bizarre way. I mean, they're just mean, white, rich Republicans.
And you know, I know a few of those.
And you know what? None of them pick up their dog poop.
You're convinced.
All right, I know.
Now, did you see Karl Rove, you know, there?
I have a photograph on my website with me and Karl Rove.
Wait.
Why are you going to think I'm... All right, wait a minute.
I saw a picture of Karl Rove getting arrested.
That one. Come here.
Okay.
You have to actually... You can look at my website, and people can join us. You can go to Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerbe.com. now it's what it is.
I see.
It's a man that has a giant... paper mache Karl Rove head on.
What a likeness.
Yeah, and prison stripes, and he's handcuffed. And I can't actually, I can't remember what it says on his signs.
Boy, that Karl Rove enjoyed that one.
Yeah, and so he was right when all the Jags and Mercedes had to come into the Republican fundraiser, they were confronted by the jailbird. And you could have your photograph taken with the Karl Rove for $2. Now,
where did the $2 go?
Well, they told me that the man had come from Spokane, Washington. I think they say Spokane.
Spokane.
Spokane, Washington, on the bus. Now, what the hell? Did he have did he have to buy an extra seat for the head?
Maybe they stored it down below.
I don't know. It's pretty big. I told somebody it wouldn't go through the door, but I think it would. It's probably. But how do you get on a bus? You know, people are so afraid of terrorism these days.
Yeah. With that.
Yeah.
Head.
Yeah. Now. And also, one of the things that Bruce and Jane did is they really put this together so that it was a non-hassle. You know, the cops were very cool.
Yeah,
and they
non-violent.
Yeah, and they were talking with them and with the police. And I'm trying to see. I can't find it. Never mind. So
they were pretty. The police were pretty tolerant.
They didn't even. Yeah, one of them.
One
of them said to, I was holding up a sign. Where's it? Oh, wait, let me go back here. I was holding up a sign with Victor, and it said, Oakland County Republicans support traitors like Karl Rove. And that's because he was part of who outed Valerie Plame, the CIA agent.
Yes, he was involved in that.
Why isn't he indicted?
Largely involved in that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is it? They never get it. They never get indicted.
Yeah, that's right.
Here.
You know, wait.
They get away with everything.
How about this? One of the main war criminals of, we were talking earlier about the Vietnam protests of the last two generations is Henry Kissinger, and an attorney for a victim of Uruguay's 1973 to 1985 dictatorship. These were what they called in Uruguay the cocaine colonels that were these torture states and also dealing major blow that they were sending up here to the United States. Anyways.
And U.S. supported.
I have to there's this woman. Anytime I say anyways, she emails me.
It is a little bothersome, Peter.
Yeah, anyway.
I'm glad that she does.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Has asked his government to request the extradition of former U.S. Secretary of State Henry Kissinger over his alleged role in the notorious Operation Condor, which was a secret plan hatched by the South American dictators to eliminate leftist political opponents in the region. The Latin American dictatorships at the time, quote, were mere executors of a plan of extermination hatched in the United States by a group led by Kissinger. All true. Kissinger actually can't go to about 40 different countries.
Isn't that amazing?
I mean, truly,
that's quite a few countries.
And do you remember that he was the first person that Bush chose to be the head of the 9/11 commission?
Yeah.
People went, whoa.
What's up with that?
The master of lies. This is just amazing. Anyway, so there was this nice demonstration. Oh, yeah. Also, there were Burma shave type signs at this protest in West Bloomfield against Karl Rove. You know what I mean? Burma shave? You know, they'd have one that would say Karl Rove. There'd be words on different signs as you go along the road. Yeah.
That's what that's called?
Yeah, because they used to say, they used to be on the highways in like in the 40s, and they would have a sign that, they would have a little rhyme. They were all over the country. Was it like a national phenomenon? They would always have a rhyme about Burma shave, which is what?
Which, I don't
Shaving
know.
Shaving cream, I think.
Now I want to know that.
Shave cream, yeah. Google it.
Okay.
Or as Bush says, go to the Google.
Is that what he said?
How is that guy still in office?
He probably says, are you taking the pot?
Taking the pot?
Yeah. Instead of smoking a little reed.
Oh.
Have you been taking the pot,
yeah, he didn't,
Jenna?
I don't think he smoked reef. He just did coke, right?
He liked the white stuff, baby.
Yeah, he had his nose on the mirror. What do we say? He snorted up half of Peru.
Yeah, maybe three quarters.
Yeah. All right. I'm not focusing. I had something else in mind, but... So Bruce and Jane put together, and I think this was MoveOn.org. If you're listening, folks, you'll have to call and tell me. And it was nonviolent, as you said, Jolene. But here, this happened in Milwaukee. One day after 21 people were arrested during a demonstration that vandalized the U.S. Army recruiting office on Milwaukee's east side, Wisconsin peace activist groups on Tuesday said some protesters might increasingly turn to destruction as their frustrations mount. Now, Let's see what happened to this.
That's unfortunate when that happens.
Well, here, the peaceful gathering contrasted sharply with the arrest Monday night at the Army Recruiting Center near the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee campus, where protesters broke a window in the recruiting station, threw smoke bombs, paint, and human excrement.
Whoa.
I mean, you must throw your own, right?
I've never pondered that question.
Yeah. I mean, nobody would throw other people's.
I gotta think about that.
It's actually gagging me up a little.
How about the dog poop that the Republicans don't pick up?
Yeah, there we go.
Remember when we were at the anti-free trade
in Miami?
Yeah, protest there, and there was a lot of violence, a lot of store windows that were broken out.
There were.
You know what happened?
You know what happened? That's after the cops attacked people, though.
Right, that's true.
But
you know what? That's the one thing I hear from people the most when I tell them, you know, that I go to this protest or that protest, is that, you know, too bad for those people who break out store windows and ruin it for all of you and make you all look crazy.
So that there's like 500,000 people come and 30 people break store windows and that makes us all look bad.
Yeah, that's I hear that a lot.
Whatever.
Yeah, pretty much what I say.
Congressman Mike Rogers' home is under police guard after his Lansing office, this is a Michigan congressman, was severely vandalized last night, which was March 20th. Cases being handled by the FBI and the U.S. Capitol Police. And two security cameras were destroyed, and they graffitied all this stuff. Said Rogers, their blood, meaning the soldiers, is on your hands. No more deaths. And what I thought was interesting was that these Milwaukee peace activist groups said protesters might increasingly turn to destruction as their frustrations mount. Now, what's that all about? We have a situation where the Republicans got swept from office last November and were essentially on the basis of opposition to the war in Iraq. And so Bush's response, because as a servant of the people, is what? Screw you! I'm doing exactly the opposite. I'm increasing the troops. The surge, which the real name is escalation. It's got Vietnam written all over it. Now, I don't think acts of violence and what have you are justified by frustration that we live in a country where we can still do mass organizing, any number of other things. But it always happens. That's what happened in the Vietnam era. More and more people protested. It was more and more widespread. And all that Nixon did was increase the violence, the war, the bombing. I mean, spread the war to Cambodia. And then people, particularly young people, just kind of freaked out. They said, yeah. I mean, I knew these people back, you know, when did I say in 71 when I was like 4 or 5 years
right.
old?
Uh-huh.
My mom and dad's friends. They would, when you said to them, how you doing? They'd say, they're bombing Vietnam.
Really?
And you'd think, hey, come on, aren't they being a little intense or
they lighten up?
Lighten up or something like that. But when you think about it and you think about what's going on now, as we speak, American soldiers are probably killing people, getting killed, destroying buildings, with Bush's policies, have creating the context for this civil war that probably means no matter what happens, no matter what the U.S. does, they're still. It's still going to continue. And the clueless Democrats, what do they say? They now they got this bill passed in the House that's really tough. They say after September 2008.
Yeah.
2008.
And even that's not going to happen, Peter.
Yeah. So that's a year and a half. How many more Americans are going to die between now and 2008? How many more Iraqis are going to die between now and 2008? How many more Americans are going to come home without legs and head wounds and all of that? We're beginning to see some of that. This is absolutely beyond belief. I mean, because the Democrats had a mandate to stop this war. Not to extend it, because essentially the vote of the Democrats that Bush is getting all twisted and bent out of shape about doesn't at all stop the war. It permits it to go on as usual.
Yeah, Bush is calling it political theater.
Oh, yeah. Is that anything like when you land on the USS Abraham Lincoln in a flight suit and declare operation or mission accomplished?
Mission accomplished. Yeah. And then remember the boxes? He did that press conference with the boxes behind them, and they said made in China, and they had to turn them around. God.
Now, You haven't seen this, but this would be pretty hard to identify, but maybe you could just tell me what category of person, I know you hate when I do this.
No, I really don't.
Okay.
I like to stretch the mind.
President Bush is a war criminal. Now, that doesn't get, you don't get much more radical than that, right? You're saying that this is somebody that ought to be frog marched out of the White House and taken to The Hague and tried in the International Criminal Court, along with people like the people that committed the genocide in Rwanda and the Milosevic's and all that. President Bush is a war criminal. Let impeachment be the first step towards national reconciliation and towards penance for the outrages committed in our nation's name. Any idea the category of, you know, like whacked out left-wing radical like me?
Oh, I'm going to say it's probably a Republican.
That, well, no,
Am
actually.
Am I right?
No, it is. Well, yeah, that would think would be the most illogical to think. It is Rocky Anderson, the mayor of Salt Lake City.
I did see this. I do have that somewhere.
Yeah, do you? Yeah. I mean, this is amazing. That now he gets like.
And why is it amazing? Because he's not. He's not liberal at all.
No, he is.
You're saying.
No, he's very liberal.
Oh.
Very.
Okay.
In fact, he says he's retiring after two terms and that he says he's going to spend the rest of his life, let me see, where did it say that? Doing stuff like anti-global warming and
genocide in Darfur.
Yeah, he's saying he wanted to devote the rest of his life to grassroots organizing involving human rights and global warming. And he presented to the Washington legislature a densely footnoted constitutional argument against Bush's presidency and doing it everywhere from the Washington legislature to peace rallies, making him a favorite punching bag of conservative talk show hosts. Who cares about those jerks?
Yeah, true.
In Utah, they in 2004, only 28% of the people voted for Kerry. So 72% of the people. At the same time, Mayor Anderson got 54% of the vote. All the non-Mormons voted for him.
Hey, I think that Romney would do well in Utah, would you say?
Yeah, I think that's
the
one
state.
That's the
only state.
That's the one state he will take.
Yeah.
Let's see here. I've got, by the way, we are now, you want to hear this show again, and you have a HD radio.
Right?
Yeah, high definition.
I don't
radio.
Have one of these yet.
You know, they're down to $100.
I know. It's no biggie.
Yeah, and you get great sound.
You get Rift 2 on
get
there.
Rift 2. And so on Rift 2, our show will be repeated at 4 a.m.
This morning.
This morning. Monday morning. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. Let's see. Do we have any callers here? Oh, yeah, we do. Hey, by the way, you can call in 313-298-WRIF. We have some open lines. That's 313-298-9743. Let's take our first caller right now. Hi, it's Peter and Jolene. You're on the air. Who's this?
John from Westland.
Go ahead. You're on the air.
What's going on with the Iranians and the British sailors?
What do you think, man?
You know, I'm an ex-sailor myself. I served aboard an aircraft carrier. I've been in the Med. I've been to the Suez Canal and the Indian Ocean. And, you know, we had jets that were aboard the ship that were launched in 5 minutes or less. If anything came within 200 miles of the aircraft carrier, the two jets would be sent out, find out what they're doing and where they're going. And these Iranians they're holding everywhere are zealous, is what I was told, hardliners.
Well, yeah, they've been captured by the government. They say they're spies. The Brits say that they were in Iraqi waters. But you know what that reminds me of? I had a buddy of mine. A really nice guy to me and to all of our friends, but he would go to this bar on the southwest side, and invariably, he'd get in a brawl. He'd always, you know, he'd come, he'd see black. I mean, he was pretty tough. I mean, he'd win a lot.
Was it over politics?
No. Okay. Yeah, he'd just get drunk. You know, he used to say, I don't have a drinking problem. I get drunk, I fall down, no problem. But,
he had that on a T-shirt.
Yeah, no, he used to, they made it up for him.
He lived it.
So this guy, he always had some bitch, you know, he's in Kim Armani, he said, you know, so then he winds up in this fight. So I said, why do you keep going back to that bar? So why the hell are the United States and Britain in that region that is, so volatile, so prone to incidents like this? That's way beyond me, I'll tell you.
I saw something that this certain area of water, Iran calls it one thing and Iraq calls it another. Did you know
that area? That whole area is disputed.
Weird. But I keep saying every time I've seen that, as it's repeated a million times on, you know, the mainstream media, is uh-oh, this ain't good.
Oh, I thought I wasn't looking at you. I thought you took a bong hit for Jesus.
You know, I was wondering if we could get, you know, I thought we should start out the show with a bong hit sound. Don't we have all Drew and Mike's effects?
They must. They must. Yeah.
You know they have that. I'm sure they have several.
You know, ever been in these restaurants now? They have hookahs.
Yeah, that's hot right now. That is a hot thing, and these younger kids go in.
You bring your own mouthpiece.
Tobacco? Oh.
They may sell the tobacco, I don't know.
Oh, okay.
But you bring your own mouthpiece, so you're not, you know, everybody's not using the same one. You're not trading spit.
I don't think I'm going to join in.
I know, me neither. All right, caller, thank you very much. We're calling him caller because our computer's a little messed up, and...
I think it was John.
Was it?
John
from
Westland.
Yeah, it was. That's what he said. You got a great memory.
I know. It's scary.
All right. We're going to take a break. Peter Werby, Jalene Jordan. This is the Night Call Show. 313-298-WRIF. 313-298-9743. And we have some open lines for you.
This is WRIF.com. done.
Make up your mind. Decide to walk with me around the lake tonight.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Well, thank you very much, and welcome back. 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. You might be able to squeeze a call in if you have a comment on some of the things that Jillian Jordan and I have talked about. I want to talk about Al Gore, but I wanted to first mention this. City commissioners in this Florida town, where the hell is it? They don't even say the name of the damn town. Who's writing
these
things?
Florida City, isn't it?
Is
that another story about Florida? Florida has a lot of news.
Anyway, city commissioners early Saturday finalized the firing of a city manager who was seeking a sex change operation despite pleas from dozens of impassioned supporters to save his job. After a six-hour hearing, the commissioners decided to fire 48-year-old Steve Stanton after his announcement that he planned a new life as a woman. Well, you can't have a transgendered city manager. I mean, because
why not?
Because well,
oh, right.
There's lots
no
of good reasons. Because
because who cares?
Yeah, who cares? Yeah, you know who these are? Always the people that are. I haven't used this phrase in a long time. The busybodies, people that aren't taking care of their own business, that are focused on other people's business. Is he gay? Is she having an abortion?
Yeah, morality.
Right. Are you having premarital sex? You know, and you find out most of the people, the more people want to intervene in the lives of others, you find out the more of a wreck their lives are.
It is true. You really do find that.
Think about all these right-wing Christian hypocrites that have been exposed over the years and just recently. The most famous, I can't even think of the guy's, Reverend Ted Haggard.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Hey, listen, Peter. He spent 3 weeks, and he is absolutely not gay now.
He is
Come
not
on.
Gay. He is not gay. He's not going to do any more amphetamines. And, yeah.
Right. Listen, my gay and lesbian friends had a lot of fun with that one.
Yeah, he had a lot of fun with the gay prostitute he was...
For 3 years!
Doing meth
and
yeah.
Other things.
We shall move on.
Right.
All right. I want to talk about Al Gore, but here, somebody's calling long distance, so let's get them on the air. Here's Ryan from Toledo. Ryan, hi. It's Peter and Jolene on WRIF.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Great.
Good. I hope my phone stays with you, but I had a caller earlier calling about the whole British sailors thing, and I like to listen to the right-wing talk radio shows just because I like to keep an eye on the 25% of the fascists in this country. And whenever Iran comes up, they start talking about Carter and how Carter blew it. Carter should have gone to war when he took those hostages in the late 1970s. And that's just kind of their thing. And we know that the people in office...
Wait a minute, isn't that Clinton's fault? I wouldn't know. They're even going back to Carter. I think it was Truman's fault.
Well, they love Truman because he dropped the bomb.
Oh, yeah. That's
they
right.
love Truman because he dropped the bomb, and they don't like Johnson. They blame Johnson for Vietnam, not Nixon. And they should share the blame.
Well, hey, the big lie about Vietnam started under Johnson, to be sure. There was no attack in the Bay of Tonkin, so to that extent... that Johnson has to stand convicted of creating this enormous war based on a lie, yeah.
Well, I don't disagree with you on that. I mean, I do think he, in terms of civil rights, I do praise the man, but I understand where we're coming from in Vietnam. But I guess the point I'm making is that we know the decider and Cheney, even if 5% of the country approves of them, they're going to do what they're going to do.
Sure.
And they've been planning, they've been scheming for years. This is well documented. With the neocons to take over the Middle East. Now with this hostage situation, if you notice, they've been trying to manufacture reasons to go to war,
mm-hmm.
like Iran is building explosives that are killing U.S. troops. Now they've got a more of a concrete reason to go to war, and my thinking is that these guys are going to just gin up the war machine, go to war with Iran, declare martial law, say, hey, we're in the middle of a war, no 2008 elections. Let's bring back the draft. I mean, it sounds laughable, but this isn't beyond reproach. I mean,
right.
I'm really concerned. What are we going to do about this?
I'll tell you. you would think that I would say, well, you're being a little extreme in your predictions. And probably what you're saying isn't going to happen, but I wouldn't put it past these guys, and I wouldn't say that it absolutely has no basis in the thinking of these people, because we know that they have no interest in democracy in the Middle East, and they have no interest in democracy in the United States. They have no interest in being constrained whatsoever, and you can tell that in the way the whole Bush mob has shredded the United States Constitution, and like this liar that is the Justice Department Attorney General, Alberto Gonzalez, here is a man who said that the Geneva Conventions are quaint and outdated, and we find out that he's conspiring to over several months ago to fire all these Republican prosecutors because they're not doing the dirty work of the Republican Party. So would they also conspire to do what you're saying, Ryan? I don't know. We should act like they will, because they've done everything else.
I don't, like I said, it's not beyond the pale, and I think you'll find that they're really gonna promote this whole hostage thing more and more as time goes on.
Well, the only thing that strikes me is this won't work. I mean, they can't defeat a bunch of irregulars, a bunch of, I've said before, I've always been taken by that one story that I read about one of the insurgents, one of the guerrillas, that said he likes to fight barefoot. So here are a bunch of men like him that are able to stop in its tracks the most powerful empire the United States has ever seen, and they're talking about doing damage to a country like Iran, which has this massive, modern, well-trained, highly equipped army with there's not even enough men to fill the ranks in Iraq without raising the age to 42 and waiving all these what they call moral waivers and all that. But they're the masters of chaos. So the fact that they would things would get even worse, like you're saying, they may use that as an excuse. They may be trying to provoke an attack in the United States. Because Iran said if they're attacked, I mean, think about this. If the United States just willy-nilly bombs Iran, where's the basis upon which we can say, hey, they can't bomb us? And since they're not going to fly any aircraft over here, they're not going to use any Tomahawk missiles, although they have a lot of that stuff, maybe they'll use what they have maybe already planted here. Who knows? Maybe what they're saying is, you hit our country, Americans, being 6,000 miles away from your home, intervening in the Middle East where you have no real business being, then you'll get back tit for tat. Can I say that? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, Peter, I wish I could say that that's far-fetched, but it's not.
Well, yeah.
It's already happened in many respects.
All right. Well, we ought to, you know, forewarned, to be sure. Thank you very much. Thanks, Ryan. Thanks for making our program interstate. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's take some more calls. We haven't had many calls on the air tonight. I do want to talk about Al Gore. Maybe we can talk about him and his Senate. And you're just dying to imitate him, aren't you?
Oh, it's so easy.
Well, hold on.
I think.
Here's Damien. Damien, hi. It's Peter and Jolene. You're on WRIF. Where are you calling from?
Roseville, Peter.
Roseville. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, I was just wondering. Let's talk about Bush a little bit. You think he sold us out?
Well, us being the American people? Definitely.
I'm on your side then, man.
Okay. Yeah. He's working for the fat cats.
I didn't know where that was going.
He's working for the boss class, the ruling class, the rulers, the people that think of all of us as a bunch of peons and peasants.
They think they rule the world. They don't know nothing, though.
I don't think they think about us at all.
You know what? I'll tell you, Damien. They do rule the world. If they didn't rule the world, if the people ruled the world, the world wouldn't be anything like this. The world wouldn't be at war. There wouldn't be hundreds and maybe, well, hundreds of millions. There wouldn't be a couple billion people living in abject poverty. There wouldn't be rampant disease. We've got enough wealth and enough wherewithal to solve all those problems. But because of this, you know, we live in a society that's shaped like a pyramid. And those at the top, the rulers at the top of the pyramid, control the vast majority of the wealth. Plus, it's consolidated. Plus, they control all these state apparatuses that have powers of army and police and what have you. So you know, we're just around, either if you're just trying to make sure you don't get fired and laid off and downsized from your job in Michigan, or you're trying to stay alive in some African country, you're at a real disadvantage to the Henry Kissingers and George Bushes and Karl Roves and the rest of these wealthy, evil people.
You ever see a video where Kissinger got confronted about the Bohemian Grove and stuff, and he got real defensive? He told the guy that it was ungentlemanly to ask questions like that.
Oh, Carl Gergen.
Carl Gergen. Oh, David Gergen. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no. No, David Gergen asked him that?
No, Alex Jones asked David Gergen.
Oh,
yeah. Bohemian Grove, and he got real defensive, got real angry.
Yeah, Bohemian Grove, by the way, folks, is just another one of these little con fabs where the rich get together and make policy. You and I get all upset about voting and elections and all that stuff. And what they have is the richy rich guys get together and the Bohemian Grove or some of these Club of Rome or stuff like that and figure it all out. Not the Illuminati. All right, Damien, thank you. Yeah. Has he sold out the people? Yeah, definitely. All right, Lo. Hey, maybe we got our computer back. It's telling us who's who. 313-298-WRIF. Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan. Here's Steve in Westland. Steve, it's Peter and Jalene. You're on the air. Hi.
How are you doing tonight, Peter?
We are doing great.
You know, I'm so glad to hear something on Detroit radio that's stops and thinks, you know. I've called you several times. I've never been able to get on the air. I spent 6 years in the Army.
Okay.
From 90 to 96. So this is like watching flashbacks on the news every night for me. Now, oddly enough, I was in military intelligence.
Uh-huh.
And what I've been saying to people for the last 2-3 years is more or less what I hear you saying on the radio, but you're not going to find it anywhere else.
No, it's unfortunate.
Find someone willing to stand up and say, hey, you really need to stop and take a look at this and what these people are trying to pull over on us.
Well, actually, Steve, there's lots of people that would be willing to do it. There's any number of talk show hosts and news analysts and reporters and what have you. But they're mostly constrained by the corporations for which they work that doesn't want people really laying it all out. Why is this happening here on WRIF? As I was saying earlier, it's because the management believes in letting me express myself. If I express myself differently, I suppose they would allow that, too. Huh? Don't you think, Jimmy?
Yeah, I suppose. But I don't know. You've been around a while, Peter.
Yeah, I mean,
if
I was a conservative, they would. I'd still be sitting here.
Do you think?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, probably a lot less people would be listening.
I would think.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Thank you, my friend. Thank you for calling in to 313-298-WRIF. Here is Fred. Fred is in Detroit. Fred, hi. You're on the air.
Oh, hi, guys.
Hi.
Basically, I'm calling about the conduct of this stupid war.
Yeah.
Now, you've referenced Vietnam a couple of times tonight.
Mm-hmm.
And I had called you maybe a month ago voicing, outrage about how the conservatives are having people who would defend this country booted out the military for their sexual orientation.
Right.
And then the other day on NPR, I happened to hear about a guy who wrote an article, I think it was in Vanity Fair or the Washington Post or New York Times or whatever, concerning Iraqis who helped this country during this war, and they're being shoved aside, they're being forgotten, they're being slighted. Much like, I think it was some Laotian natives during the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
You know, at the end of the war, we did not come to their rescue. We did not get them out of the country, even after they, had helped us in the jungle.
Some of them did. Some of them, the Hmong people are in, Minneapolis. Yeah, well, it's going to be
St. Paul.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting what happens after this is done. Because as it is, millions of people are either internal refugees inside of Iraq or some of them have gone to Jordan and Syria, and any number of them would like to come here. But, of course, the United States, they're not going to let that go on. They don't want more Iraqis here, given the kind of prejudices that exist. So
I heard something about that the other day, Peter, that this is, people don't realize, but just within the last 2 to 3 months, this has become the biggest refugee crisis in the world. The Iraqis.
Yeah,
it just must be. In the last couple of months.
All right, thank you very much, Fred. Appreciate your call. 313-298-WRIF. Remember, we were talking about this last week, Jolene. Remember, we were wondering, how in the world did the Republicans, these guys that are old enough, all scammed out of the draft in Vietnam, and somehow were able to wear the mantle of the protectors of our troops, supporting our troops. And then we come to find out that everything they do is the opposite, including the VA clinics, all that scandal that happened at Walter Reed. Well, yeah. they had this big investigation that was ordered by the VA Secretary Jim Nicholson, and it turns out this vast network of 1,400 health clinics and hospitals is beset by maintenance problems such as mold, leaking roofs, and even a colony of bats. This is terrible.
Horrible.
It's all over the world. Imagine that, of what the trauma that these men and some women have suffered, the injuries. Have you've seen those now. They're starting to come, starting to see these.
Stories are coming out of people are back here, yes.
Yeah. Well,
people who are outraged, family members and things like that.
And it turns out, of course, that Bushco, the Bush Incorporated, the racket posing as a government, that that they were trying to privatize all this stuff. And the Army contract to privatize maintenance at Walter Reed, for instance, was delayed more than 3 years amid bureaucratic bickering and legal squabbles that led to staff shortages in a hospital in disarray, just as the number of severely wounded soldiers from Iraq and Afghanistan were rising rapidly. And we talked about this a few weeks ago. The disputes involved hospital management, the Pentagon, Congress, and IAP Worldwide Services, Inc., a company with powerful political connections, which means, of course, to Bushco. And it means it's Dan Quayle. And we actually, maybe someone can remind us.
I interrupted his dinner.
What?
Remember when I interrupted Dan Quayle's dinner with his daughter? I told you that story.
Oh, when you were...
I was so rude. I just went right up. Hello, Mr. Quayle.
Why? I mean, when you were a TV reporter?
Well, no, I was having dinner at the same restaurant.
Really?
And the manager told me that Dan Quayle was in the other room. And I go, don't worry, I won't do anything. And I went over there and interrupted his dinner. And he was actually nice about it, but his daughter just gave me the stink eye. Yeah.
And is he from Iowa?
No, he was...
From Indiana.
A lot of politicians like to go to Iowa, you know?
Yeah. Hey, what the hell, man? That's what I do. I mean, a lot of times I thought, you can go to Hawaii, you can go to Costa Rica, you can go to Paris. Me, I go to Sioux Falls.
Woohoo!
Yeah, all right. Here's Tim in Washington Township, the home of the Octagon House. Go ahead, you're on the air.
How you doing, Peter Werby?
I'm doing great.
I just wanted to talk about Brazil. I was wondering if you and Jillian are aware that Brazil is now 100% ethanol.
Are they doing that? What are they making their ethanol from? Not from corn.
I have no idea. I didn't research that, but I know Bush flew down there about 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
And we're either going to attack them next. We're either going to attack Brazil, or we're going to force a heavy tariff on their shipments. They want to send in 3 billion barrels. That's how many they have, 3 billion barrels excess they want to sell to America. America uses about 8 billion barrels a year, so that's one-third of the oil company's profits.
Yeah.
And I don't want to knock your buddy there. I know how you like Chavez over there in Venezuela, but the reason he sent that 100 million, in my opinion only, 100 million tons of oil to America for the poor, is simply because he doesn't want to see us go into ethanol. And if you give somebody candy long enough free, hey, they're going to remember you.
Well, you can't use ethanol as heating fuel. And what through CITGO, the Venezuelan government, is providing cheap heating oil.
Yeah, it's not for your car.
Yeah, so it's not for your car. And actually, Chavez isn't my buddy. I mean,
he does care about the poor more than George Bush does.
He sure,
you say?
Yeah, he sure does. And so much of the billions of oil profits, rather than going to the elite of Venezuela, and even worse, going to the investors in other countries, he's using the profits to this to sow all back into Venezuela to try to solve some of its problems of all those countries that have been so distorted by colonialism and imperialism and essentially looting of their economies for the the wealthy of the northern tier countries. Now, I'll tell you, I don't, for one thing, that as I've said, all oil usage at every level as an energy source is poisonous. From the wellheads to the shipping, the refinery, and finally for burning it in your cars, in which this is actually a good lead-in. We'll talk about Al Gore when we come back. In fact, we will do that right now because I have to get these spots in before midnight. So, Tim, thank you very much for raising it. Peter Werby, Jolene Jordan, Jillian, I like that. Is it all right if I call you Jillian? Or just don't call you late for lunch?
Yeah.
Right. All right. We'll be right back.
You're listening to WRIF.com. visiting WRIF.com. More Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Well, thank you very much. And get out of here with this media. Yeah, all right, there we go. Jolene Jordan is with me, and our numbers are 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. There's open lines. We haven't been getting any of the emails that people have been sending. I mean, we've gotten them.
We did now.
Yeah, yeah. And we had one we were talking earlier that normally the show is brought to you by the Waking Up Store. And it looks like they're going to be ending their stint at the Universal Mall, but you can still go to their wakingupstore.com. These are such good folks. And Mike Kitchen, the proprietor, you have an email there?
Yeah, yeah. He said the last day is Sunday, April 29th, that they're going to be open. Did you say that already?
No, okay. I didn't know that.
And so get in there and get some merchandise over there at the Universal Mall. There's a big plan. They're changing its form, and it may not include, you know, retail stores like, like this. So they'll still have the website, and it's he thanks us for our kind words.
No,
and
they deserve it.
Said that a cab driver went in their store one afternoon and said he had me in his cab one day. Lord knows what that was about, and that I was talking about the store. And so, very cool. I'm glad that that cab driver passed that along to you. So, wakingupstore.com. And he said, you can bet that when we return, we'll be back here sponsoring your show, Peter.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Well, thanks to Mike and Denise from WakingUpStore.com. And one of the things, terrible to say, but I'm sure when you're going out of business, they usually have things at discount. But it would also help them, I think, to eliminate. You don't want to and you know, have a store filled with inventory. So go on out there or go to their site first and see what's happening. We were talking about the possibility of an attack on Iran. And Robert wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. There's something called Operation Bite, and I don't know where this is sourced from, but it says April 6th, sneak attack by U.S. forces on Iran planned, Russian military sources warn. And they say the long-awaited U.S. military attack on Iran is now on track for the first week of April, specifically by 4 a.m. on April 6th, the Good Friday opening of the Easter weekend, writes the well-known Russian journalist Andrei Uglanov in the Moscow Weekly Argumenti Nedeli. Uglanov cites Russian military experts close to the Russian general staff for his account. Maybe that's not why they're not... no, they didn't get the money from Iran. Iran didn't come up with the money for their nuclear facilities. They owe a payment or something.
Where's
like
this guy getting his info? That's what I want.
I don't know. I mean, I just keep thinking...
I like hearing that. And you have that bet you need to win.
Yeah, I'm betting that the United States will not attack Iran. But the only thing going for it is, for one thing, these... Well, here... this is from Roderick. Roderick says, hi, both of you. Man, I guess just to keep it simple, these Republican Bush administration people are just plain nut jobs.
Well, yeah.
And they are.
Yeah.
So this is very frightening.
We agree.
A rumor for you. I've heard that Bush has been on psych drugs back in his first term. He's probably still on them. He's probably getting fried. He's getting weirder and weirder.
I think he needs them, though.
Yeah.
If there's ever a candidate. Right.
Some of our best friends are on meds.
Right. Absolutely. Maybe he does need them.
Also, we were talking about the city in Dearborn. No, Dearborn. I'm giving it away. In Florida, where the transgendered city manager got fired.
Yeah.
Because you just can't have a transgender city manager because, why can't you?
I certainly don't. I can't come up with anything.
Yeah. Anyway.
I have a lot of transgender friends, by the way.
Okay.
Yeah.
Dave, you're supposed to say Dearborn. I don't know why that slipped out of my mouth. It's Dearborn. I know. They all say Dearborn.
Who's they?
The Dearbornites.
The people who live in Dearborn?
Yeah. Dearborn.
Really?
You know,
I'm going to be there at a riff gig, by the way, on Tuesday night at Buffalo Wild Wings. Come out and see me.
Oh, God.
In Dearborn.
This is where they
say it that way.
People just eat chicken wings.
And they have them really, really, really hot.
Oh, that's right. It's a sponsor. Yeah, they're great. Hey. I'm going to open up I'm going to open up a place that sells chicken feet.
Oh, you are?
Yeah.
Talons and all?
Yeah, well, My mother-in-law used to make chicken soup, and she'd have the chicken feet in the soup for flavor, and then she would, like, pick it up and go...
No.
Yeah, and that's not a bong hit, although we do say bong hits for Jesus on this show. But anyway,
yeah.
Dave from Dearborn, as I say, and one more digression, it is rumored that Henry Ford, whose first big plant, the Rouge plant, the famous worldwide famous plant, that white workers lived in Dearborn, and the black workers had to live in Inkster.
You know, a guy in my band told me that story, and he was telling me that it was...
I don't know if it's true.
Well, you know, he's convinced it is, and he's always pulling my leg, you know, and so I said, oh, come on. He told my dad this story, so then I thought, well, maybe it is true, because he... Yeah. Why would he?
Well, and if you're listening and think, band, she has a band. You don't know that Jolene Jordan has a band. You can go to Juline Jordan, Jordan, JolineJordan.com, and you can see all her stuff.
Yeah.
We're going to have a Jolene page on the Peter Worthing page as well.
It's out of date, but I do have a gig coming up in May. You know, I came back to work at the Riff, and you never know when I'm going to be on the streets, and I kind of keep it open. Took a little break, but we'll be playing in May.
Anyway. Here, this is Dave from Dearborn. The city where the city manager was fired is Largo, Florida. I was a former police dispatcher for Largo, Florida. Largo is on the Gulf Coast between Clearwater and St. Petersburg.
Okay.
St. Pete. Isn't that curious how, what a coincidence?
World?
Small world.
Oh, it sure is.
Small world it is. I keep feeling, other talk shows, sometimes people stay on the line like for an hour and a half.
They do?
Oh, yeah.
Keep them on there?
Yeah, but I can't do this. So we're going to get Miguel.
That's because it's ADD
Miguel
radio.
From St. Clair Shores. Go ahead, Miguel. Hi, it's Peter and Jolene on WRIF, and so are you. You're on the air. Hi.
Hey, I just called in before because you guys were speaking about Bush and about Gore and everything.
Uh-huh.
And I was just wondering, why don't we go back? Why don't we go back to when he was first elected and those elections and how they were screwed up?
2000.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, Gore was elected in 2000, but Bush stole the election. Is that what you meant?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just preposterous that you see them doing this, and it just, like, strikes a bell that maybe they did that. I mean, you can never exactly know what's going on because we can't believe them anymore. Now they're liars.
Well, we never could, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the problem. I mean, for one thing, if you think about it, Bush lost, even if you want to say that everything was on the up and up in Florida with his brother, in his brother's state, with the Secretary of State of Florida who controlled the voting process, that was on the up and up. Bush still lost the popular vote. Now, you would think that he would say, well, I have to rule as a compromise president. I'm compromised to begin with because the majority of people did not want me in the presidency. In other words, the loser, what kind of contest is that? The loser becomes the winner. I don't understand this. I guess it's called the Electoral College. But in any event, you would think that he would say, okay, I got to be a moderate. Instead, he puts into place this far right-wing agenda that attacks all of the gains of the last 75 years, beginning with the Roosevelt administrations, and acts out an agenda that has been put together by these people in the new American century, which includes a war against Iraq and Iran. So... this ain't new, folks.
That's good point. Never forget.
Yeah, right. You do, because our historic and political memories are about a week long. Huh?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know what most people are waiting for, Peter?
What?
We're busy talking about things that are, like, really important. They're waiting for tomorrow when Anna Nicole Smith's autopsy results are released. Big stuff.
She was poisoned by... Sheikh Khalid Mohammed. He confessed to that as well.
JFK.
9/11 bombing, the OJ killing. What's her name?
Nicole Brown Simpson. He took care of her, yeah.
Nicole. What was her first name?
Nicole.
Yeah. And what was the other one? Oh, no. Are we talking about the same one? I'm totally losing it. What's the Playboy model's name?
Oh, that Nicole Smith.
But the other one was Nicole Brown.
Yeah.
So, Nicole.
Right.
Think about this, folks. Can you say Illuminati? I can. It's the only program in America that dares say Illuminati and bong hits for Jesus. Oh, hey, a little later on, we're going to be interviewing. Actually, just I will. Deepa Fernandez, who has written a book called Targeted, Homeland Security and the Business of Immigration. Because like everything else in this country, we get all whipped up about it, and then the biggies are getting rich off it. And this is going to really be startling, of because can you say Halliburton, right? So guess who's making the money? All right, let's talk about Al Gore. We want to talk about Al Gore. All right, do your Al Gore imitation.
Well, he was in Congress this week, right?
Yeah.
Speaking about global warming and saying that it's a planetary emergency, which I would have to agree with. And he said, if your baby has a fever, you take your baby to the doctor.
And he's the doctor.
That's right.
Dr. Gore.
Dr. Gore.
Is he going to be, he should wind up to be the presidential candidate. Get rid of Hillary. So it would be Gore and Obama.
That
would probably work.
An idea.
That would work.
So?
Now, all, of course, the Republicans, like Representative Joe Barton from Texas, Republicans, he said he didn't agree with it. He didn't think there was global warming. And the totally insane Senator James M. Inhofe of Oklahoma said it is my perspective that you are talking about Gore. Global warming alarmist pronouncements are now and have always been filled with inaccuracies and misleading statements. This is the senator from Oklahoma, the Republican. Well, okay. So you have the senator from Oklahoma saying that it's just a load of crap. On the other hand, you have about 1,000 scientists that are supposed to be, let me see, where is it here? Oh, here. This is from Bill McKibben. Earlier this month, a draft White House report was leaked to the news outlets. A report a year overdue to the United Nations said that the United States could be producing almost 20% more greenhouse gases in 2020 than in 2000. So it's going up.
Or 2000, right.
Yeah, in 2000. But wait a minute. That was not the one that I was looking for. That what the hell happened to that? There was this thing that was overdue to the United Nations. But anyway, the harmful effects of global warming on daily life are already showing up, and within a couple of decades, hundreds of millions of people will not have enough water, top scientists are likely to say next month at a meeting in Belgium. Oh, this is what I was looking for, yeah. The draft document, the second of a series of four being issued this year, focuses on global warming's effects, written and reviewed. These are the top academics, the meteorologists, the climatologists, all these people. 1,000 scientists from dozens of countries are the ones that are submitting that global warming is threatening the very existence of humanity on the planet. So there is your choice, dear listeners. You can either believe Senator Inhofe from Texas, or no, he's from Oklahoma, the senator from Oklahoma, or 1,000 people whose task it is to figure these things out. Let's say, and there was actually a publication years ago called A Minority of One, and that can be. Everybody can be wrong and one person can be right. So Senator Inhofe can be correct. Maybe this is just, what do they say? It's just the variation, planetary variation. Because there's been real hot periods before and real cold periods before and all that. So he says this is a natural variation.
That's one of the biggest arguments.
Let's say that he's right. Let's say that all these scientists are absolutely wrong. And in fact, James M. Inhofe is correct. Does that mean then you still want to burn fossil fuels? Ever hear of something like asthma that is increasing by leaps and bounds among young children, and particularly urban kids? And do you really think that you can keep burning coal and oil and have nuclear power plants without there being any effect? Forget about global warming. I mean, we shouldn't. We'll sidebar that for a minute. It's somebody used to say to us. And just think about, so don't do any global warming. I don't believe this. I believe that there's global warming. But we'll take his argument. Still, we would say that that we should reduce to next to nothing the use and dependence on fossil fuels. And they have other little side effects like wars, because you know, everybody wants to control the oil. And the other thing is, say that you have 1,000 scientists who say, yes, global warming is caused by human action, and you have Senator Inhofe that says it isn't. So what if the scientists are are wrong, and we do everything they say and everything that Al Gore says. We actually have a more environmentally sound planet. We have less pollution. We have less asthma. We don't have to worry about nuclear waste. We don't have oil spills. We don't have wars for oil. And we thought, oh, well, gee, we were wrong about global warming, but we've got all these other benefits. If Inhofe is wrong, we're screwed worse than we already are.
That's true.
Yeah. All right, 313-298-WRIF, Peter Werby, Jalene Jordan, and here's Paul in Brighton. Paul, hi, you're on WRIF. Thanks for joining us.
Hello.
Hi.
How are you doing?
We're doing great. At least I am.
We're doing all right here, too.
Yeah.
Well, you got a break. Well, Michigan and that like crazy lady we got in there. I don't know how we ever voted a lady from Canada into our jurisdiction, but...
Wait. You think we should have put in this far right-wing Republican? What's the matter with you?
No. It's not actually your fault anyway. But raising everything 2% while nobody has any money isn't a good idea.
Well, I'll tell you.
If you're saying Wisconsin, it's like we don't live in Wisconsin.
I agree with you 100%, Paul. Yeah.
You know, it's like they want to get some money out of us. Here, let's legalize what Antoine lied to the Supreme Court to make so illegal. We could be getting funds from that, take the drug dealers off the street, because they won't be able to sell it, and the government would be making money from it.
Paul, let me just tell people that may be listening in other parts of the country that Senator Jennifer Granholm, who in fact was born in Canada.
Governor.
It was the governor, yeah. That she wanted to have a 2% tax because that the jobs have been fleeing Michigan so quickly that we're really in a problem area. So the 2%, though, that's the kind of thing they call a regressive tax, that it would have fallen mostly and hurt poorer people the most, because 2% to upper middle class and wealthy people is not going to hurt them very much. But when we already have almost 8% unemployment, I think it's the highest in the country, isn't it, Jolene? I think so.
Well, we are number one in a lot of things like that.
Yeah, there you go. And so it was a terrible idea. What you got to have is an income tax that hits the people that are still doing real great under the Bush economy, which privileges the privileged and hurts the middle class and the working class.
That lady that you had talking last week, I like with her, but how do we take back our country from these crazy warmongers?
Well,
it's not helping us with what they're trying to do.
I don't know.
Because like she said, you know, but we got to fight. Like, let's get our militias back up.
Hey, you know, Paul, do you use the Internet at all?
Huh? Internet?
Yeah.
I don't actually have a computer.
All right. Well, good.
Good for you.
Don't waste your money. It's a way to suck your money and your time.
Peter, what you usually say is stay as sweet as you are.
Yeah, stay as sweet as you are. Go to my website, Peter Werby, WERBE.com. On there, you can go to a library or something like that, and Congressman Dennis Kucinich from Cleveland, who's making another bid for the presidency. And of course, he doesn't have hundreds of millions from the corporation, so he won't get anywhere. But he has some suggestions on how to end the war in Iraq and how to begin impeaching George W. Bush for high crimes and misdemeanors, of which they are numerous. But what he was talking about, drugs, about the legalizing marijuana. Did he say that?
I wasn't sure. He was talking about legalizing something, but I wasn't sure.
Well,
I just kept thinking of that Bob Marley song. It was
Legalize It?
Yeah. Or was that Peter Tosh?
One of them.
Probably both.
Yeah. let's see. Indiana House Republican. This is from Alternet. That's a good site. I don't ever talk about it too much. Alternet. Alternet. Alternet.org. Indiana House Republican Mark Sauter, a White House point man in Congress for its propaganda war against drugs, recently took to the airwaves to defend one of the Bush administration's sacred cows, its National Youth Anti-Drug Media Campaign. You know, when you hear, what is that again, the M, you know, we always hear that, brought to you by this station or something in the, I can't remember what the hell the name of it, but those are all paid, those aren't public service announcements, those are actually paid, I'm just looking at this. Those are paid ads. If you've had access to a television or a newspaper, pardon me, over the past few years, you're probably familiar with the federal ad campaign. It's one that's spent over $2 billion since 1998 to produce public service announcements implying that smoking pot supports Al-Qaeda and may make you pregnant, among other dubious anti-drug messages.
Yes, yeah. I remember these. Ugh.
So dubious, in fact, that the campaign has flopped miserably among its target audience. Of course, this fact matters not to the White House, which recently demanded $130 million to run ads through 2008, a 31% increase over current funding levels. And let's see, a 2002 review by the research firm Westat said no statistically significant decline in marijuana use or improvement in beliefs and attitudes about marijuana use attributable to the media campaign showed up.
You know what? I think those to a lot of people, we just kind of giggle when we see things like that.
Yeah, yeah. Or I think, if anything, it probably has that effect on young people that say, wait a minute, they're telling me not to do it. I'll do it.
Right, that's true.
Because that's, yeah, kids do that a lot.
Reverse psychology
thing.
Yeah,
it is. Kids are into transgression, you know, breaking the rules.
Oh, I know, like, I was.
Should I say my same little thing about how I experimented with drugs in college? Marijuana, yeah, and it was a success. You know,
I'll never get tired of that one.
Well, you know what? It is. It's so bizarre. I heard somebody else say that they where did they get this weird thing? You know, experimented with it. I suppose it's becoming a drug addict. You know,
right? But yeah. The experiment by saying that makes it okay. Is that what you're saying?
I guess. Yeah, it means it was a youthful indiscretion.
Right.
Right. Right. Here is Adam and Romulus. Adam, it's Peter and Jolene. You're on WRIF. Go ahead.
Hello, Peter. It's nice to talk to you again. And hi, Jolene.
Hi.
Good to hear a female perspective.
Thank you.
You know, it's so hard to sit on hold with you because every time you have a new caller, a new subject, you know, you just want to talk about something else. But I called to talk to you about the Warren impeachment, so I'll try to stick to that here. First of all, as far as the war goes, one of the things you like to say all the time is that the United States has a plan to invade every country in the world, including Canada. Usually when you talk about Canada, somehow that'll get mixed in. What happened to the plan that we had to invade Iraq? Because it seems like whatever plan they might have had sure hasn't worked out very well for them now, has it?
No, it hasn't. Well, let me just... I've repeated that any number of times, like the same stupid joke I tell over and over again. But the Pentagon has contingency plans for invasion and occupation of every country in the world. And as I always say...
Yeah, I did not know that. Every country in the
world? Yeah. I mean, like Liechtenstein and Andorra, they get like a 3x5 card, right?
Okay.
But like the invasion and occupation of Mexico, of Canada, that's there. These big, you know, what you call them? I mean, they're contingent strategies. Like, for instance...
So they sit around and play war?
Yeah, well, I mean, you could say for a big empire that you would... It doesn't seem that unusual. In other words, say that something really weird, like a fascist dictatorship took over in Canada, and they were starting to make aggressive noises towards the United States, which is a little preposterous. Well, they wouldn't all of a sudden go, hey, what do we do? Maybe we ought to start figuring out some war plans. So they have all this. But, yeah, for England and Italy and Russia, I mean, all during the Cold War.
For our buddies?
Yeah. All during the Cold War, the United States had all sorts of attack plans, nuclear strike attack plans on the Soviet Union, invasion and occupation plans. And now that all the Soviet files are open, turns out, of course, that the Russians, just as they said, had absolutely no plans for the invasion of Western Europe, certainly no plans for an attack or invasion of the United States. I mean, after a while, they were able to develop intercontinental ballistic missiles that because they thought... that the United States were just crazy. I mean, they thought that they were planning to attack and occupy them.
Well, really?
Yeah. Actually, Helen Caldicott, who we interviewed the other...
Last week,
yeah. She had the most frightening thing, because all of these nuclear missiles are still on hair triggers in Russia, which is an extraordinarily unstable country. Putin offered to reduce a lot of it. Bush, of course, said no. And
now he's mad again at Bush.
Yeah, he's mad. And who knows who's going to take over Russia? And there's terrible security. They could be launched by just a nut. I mean, they could be launched by a nut here. But they have something called dead hand. And it means if they get if their command center is knocked out in Moscow, something is automatically launched, which then launches all the Soviet missiles that they have, like thousands.
Wow.
And you'll be pleased to know. There's only 3 or 4 hydrogen warheads right now aimed at the city of Detroit. I mean, this is for real. I mean, she scares the crap out of me.
God.
She does.
Helen Caldicott? With what she was telling
you. Yeah, I mean, we should be. Wait a minute. Here's Al from Inkster. Al, what do you think about that rumor that Inkster was set up by Henry Ford, this anti-Semitic racist, where they could park his black workers? Any truth in that?
There may be some. Inkster was originally a Jewish suburb.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah, right on Michigan Avenue, there's an old Jewish cemetery.
Really?
It was really it was a Jewish enclave, and since they were supporters of African Americans back in the day, that's probably why a lot of blacks settled here, because the Jews would probably be the only ones that would have sold to them.
Wow. Hmm. Well, anyway, go ahead.
But I called to talk about drug policy.
Go ahead.
I said no to drugs. They didn't listen, but I said no.
I said maybe to drugs.
Yeah, no.
Hugs and drugs. No. No drugs. Don't do drugs. Particularly, I'm very serious about this. If you're a young person, you should not do drugs. Just like I don't support. I mean, well, never mind. It's kind of hard. You know, I mean, if you're a teenager, it ain't the best thing for you. It's something that you should do when you're an adult, if you choose. And the government should get out of your life. If I want to, you know, give me the information, show me what marijuana does, show me what crack does, show me what heroin does, show me what methamphetamines do. You've done your job. And if I'm a moron enough to get addicted to stuff and to abuse a substance like that, well, then don't arrest me. Put me in some mental or physical
health. Go to rehab like everyone else.
Go to rehab. Come on.
That's what I wanted to talk about is, you know, if all the crisis facing the state financially, why are we paying money to put nonviolent drug offenders in prison?
Because there is a prison industrial complex.
They need to fill those.
Just like there's a military industrial complex. Yeah, dope. Smokers and people that use drugs and sell drugs, they are the clients for the prison industrial complex. And then there's the military industrial complex, which is taking most of our money, is what's going on right now. And then, as our guest at 1 a.m. Eastern Time will tell us, then there's now the immigration industrial complex. So it's all just quite a racket, and it all just is fueled by our money.
And you know who is one of the owners?
Thanks, Al. Bye.
Oh, Barbara Bush is big into the military-industrial complex. She owns.
Why can I always forget the name of that? Her husband is in the, what do you call the group? What's the name of that group? It begins with an S or a C or Carlyle Group.
Oh, yeah. But she, I think, also has her own business interests in the...
Really? Walt writes into Call Talk Yes. Did I say that? Anything like it really sounds? Call Talk Yes at yahoo.com. Walt says, I like your show, but do not agree with your praise of Hugo Chavez of Venezuela. He has abolished the Venezuelan legislature and taken absolute power. This isn't true. He hasn't done that. And although he was and may still be popular in that country, he's very popular, I do not see him giving up power if that changes. To me, it seems like a run-of-the-mill dictatorship whose final legacy will be bloodshed and oppression. I think you should reconsider your position on him. Well, I'll tell you, I don't want to get off on this, but my position is very nuanced. That is, has a lot of aspects to it. Hugo Chavez is extremely popular in his country. He's been elected, and he has suspended certain aspects of allowing him to govern by executive decree, which has been done any number of times before in Venezuelan history and is permitted under the Constitution. I, like you, Walt, am very suspicious of all government power of any government anywhere in the world. And does Hugo Chavez have the capacity to be an old-fashioned Latin American caudillo, as they call him? Can Chavismo turn into a dictatorship? Sure. And it worries me, the idea that he's going to try to integrate all of the parties into something called the United Socialist Party is worrisome as well. Right now, what I've always said about him is that he is funneling lots of money into the poor of his country. I don't think there are political prisoners, but there has been more police repression of demonstrations. There's enormous repression of demonstrations here in the United States. You know that there was a protest at the 2004 Republican Convention in New York City, and the New York City cops sent out undercover agents to infiltrate meetings all across the country. Not in New York City.
Peace meetings.
Peace meetings. Of the protesters. And
you find out, you know, they were going to make signs with flowers on them. Oh.
Yeah. So governments, you know, 99% of all governments have been absolutely and totally repressive. I mean, since the 17th century and into the 18th century, a few of them have given a few rights to people. I mean, the government is an extraordinarily dangerous institution. And would I be surprised if Chavez took this route towards absolute power? No. But in the meantime, one of the things that almost all dictators do, you know, it's not as true of left-wing dictators, but all right-wing dictators, of course, are just total rackets of the Bush mold that are just function to get money for the rich and the elite. Now, in like the Soviet dictatorships and the socialist dictatorships and the ones that still remain in North Korea and Cuba and what have you, they meet at least some of the economic vision of socialism. That is a sharing of the economic whatever wealth of the country, but still they, you know, the fact that a government rules by absolute power, they have somebody in there for 40 or 50 years like Castro, or they got a family in there like Kim's in Korea, that doesn't even meet the formal definitions of socialist democracy. And I'm always appalled by the fact that socialists and leftists that I know will apologize for this one man rule in Cuba. And I know there's lots of democracy in Cuba on a local level, and but I mean, that's what I mean. It's a very complicated situation, but I think that the proper stance is being critical of anyone, any political leader, any government that that rules in the manner that doesn't isn't founded incredibly on democracy. And I'm sorry, I mean, I know that Chavez has become this incredible hero to liberals and leftists, but I agree with you all. We have to be very, very careful, and we would do better to be critical of the Chavez and the Castros, particularly from the left. In other words, saying you're not being socialist enough, you're not being democratic enough, rather than just you know, being apologists for some of the aspects that we know from history do not work out well in the long run. Does that make any sense to people? I hope so.
It made sense to me.
Well, good.
I was concentrating. Did you see me?
I did. Your brow was furrowed. That's Jelaine Jordan, and I'm Peter Werby. You can call us at 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743, and we'll be right back.
Looking out there.
The pictures.
The podcast.
The blog.
The special features you just can't get
anywhere else.
Super f***ing cool.
Get them online at WRIF.com.
I shall do just that.
Or check us out at MySpace.com/WRIF.
Guaranteed to be extreme.
Because we can always use more friends, and we won't be naked.
Does anyone else smell Astroglide?
101.
W-R-I-F.
People are sexy and clever, and they always say something funny right before the commercial break.
Everything that rocks.
You're listening to WRIF.com. WRIF.com.
Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back to our final segment for this evening. Joining me in the studio, Jalene Jordan.
And I wish it were longer, Peter. You know, the show.
Good.
Oh, here we go again. Don't do it.
We couldn't go to commercials now. We started laughing last week. We were out of control. Yeah.
You know, I've been still laughing all week. This is bad. It's radio for two. We have other people out there.
Right. Well, they were saying the guy is going to, he wants to give up Wikipedia because of juvenile humor.
And here we go.
Here we go, yeah. All right. 1 a.m., Deepa Fernandez, author, Targeted, Homeland Security and the Business of Immigration. Oh, yeah, and also an author. Actually, this is a repeat show, but it's an interview I did with somebody about a book about Che Guevara, talking about Cuba.
Cool.
And also talk about my trip to Cuba. So this must be from 2 years ago because I went there in February 05.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, I'm real critical, as I said earlier, of the fact that there is this ruling clique there. I know he's doing it in the interest of the revolution and all that. But, you know, if I was in Cuba, I'd be in a world of trouble.
What do you mean?
I mean, I'd probably be arrested for because if I...
If you were speaking out?
Yeah, because they say everything possible within the revolution, nothing outside. Well, let me tell you this. I mean, the people that I identify with in Cuba, they're not even there anymore. These people that are called anarcho-syndicalists, they were trade unionists, and they went back in the early... Man, this is too obscure. Altitude quickly. Late 19th century. They were these trade unionists, and they were really militant, and they fought the Spanish, because it was a Spanish colony. And then when the United States, another war based on a lie, the Spanish-American War in 1898 to, 1900 or something like that, took all these Spanish possessions, Guam and Philippines, Puerto Rico, and set Cuba up as an independent country, but put in the place of these Spanish colonialists all these vicious dictators. Machado and at the end Batista, and all through that, these anarcho-syndicalist independent unions that fought for the workers, and that was their main goal, the rights and betterment of the workers. None of these dictatorships, none of these the Spanish colonialists could repress the anarcho-syndicalist movement. Hasn't been then 1959. Poof, they're gone.
Really?
Yeah, most of them fled. I mean, it's not like they're
pretty daring of them.
Well, yeah, but it's just that the Cuban government under Castro was just so repressive of anybody that operated independently. And now, I mean, if you pass out a leaflet saying, "Hey, I think we should have an independent a union that's independent of the government," man, you're off to jail. That's horrible. Uh-huh. And for instance, I haven't even told you this at the end of April, I'm going to go to New York for an organizing conference for our union. In other words, how to organize more people into the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists.
Okay.
Not here, guys. Yeah, with the management's listening. Not here. We're going to do
it. No worries.
No worries. You were talking earlier about the song Legalize It, and you weren't sure whether it was...
Barley or Peter Tosh.
Yeah. And James is listening in Kenosha, Wisconsin, and writes in the call talk yes at yahoo.com. He says, here's a quick story. He says, I'm a student at the University of Wisconsin. I think he means I was, because I think he has, grown kids, as I remember. He's written this before. My little brother comes to join me at a Peter Tosh concert at a nightclub called The Church Key. Halfway through the show, my little brother takes out a joint and lights it up.
Okay.
I'm too stunned to stop him. As far as we were concerned, it was Peter Tosh in Madison, and firing up a joint was as natural as a beer at a football game. I tried to explain to him that the world had changed, and he best put it out. Or maybe this is now. I don't know. Write us back, James. I mean, am I putting too many years on you? Maybe he's 22 or something.
Yeah, you
got
to be in Amsterdam to do that.
Absolutely. All right, here is Frank is in Ann Arbor. Frank, it's Peter and Jalene on WRIF. You're with us. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. I was just going to bring up a couple points here.
Please.
Recently, James Baker came out and said Gore won the election in Florida.
And, come on.
He did.
James Baker is one of the Bush family consiglieres who managed the Bush theft of the 2000 election. So,
of the 2000 election, yeah.
Yeah. So where did he say that? I can't believe this, Frank.
Yeah, I have another issue, too, and that the administration is selling off highways to foreign countries. I'm not sure if you brought that up recently.
I did. They're selling, they're selling off everything. I mean, the Chinese, who are the only reason that the government of the United States is solvent, because they keep buying billions of dollars of treasury bonds, as recently said, they're not going to buy any more treasury bonds because the return on it is so low. So maybe they should buy, like, Chrysler or something like that. They would do it. I mean, they seem to be efficient. The suits over there in Frankfurt and Rochester Hills don't seem to be up to it. All right, thank you very much. Let's go to Belleville and talk to Todd. Todd, hi, you're on the air. Hey, Todd. Todd.
Yeah.
Todd, talk to me, Todd.
It's a bad connection.
Yeah, it's not a bad connection, it's a cell phone. So, wait a minute. I'm going to put you on hold, all right? Go find a better location. We'll get back to you. I mean, move a few feet or something like that. Here's Don. Don is in Detroit. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hello, how are you?
We're good.
I have a question about the detained UK Marines.
Okay.
What is your point of view on actually invading from the UK, the US, or even Israel? What is your total point of view?
Not sure what your question
about
is.
About invading Iran, you mean?
Yes. Because England is our, ally,
uh-huh.
Obviously.
Right.
And so is Israel. So I just kind of wonder your thoughts on that.
Well, why is the Middle East so screwed up? You could attribute it to any number of things, but a great part of it is the residual effect of British imperialism and colonialism that did such damage and looted that region with such intensity beginning in the 19th century and through into the 20th century. And also carved out countries where there weren't countries, in many cases, that threw together people that had no business being in the same country together. So, I mean, when something happens on Sunday, March 25th in 2007, and you say, well, what's the opinion here? When you're dealing with a problem that goes back 100 years or more than 100 years, and say, what's the solution? Well, it's not that easy, because all these bright guys in suits that were so confident of their ability to alter the world and to enrich themselves at the expense of so many other people turn out to be totally screwed up. And it ought to be a lesson to learn that their predecessors, they're not predecessors, their successors, the people today running England, running Britain, Israel, who's learned absolutely nothing over the last few decades, continue to make the same mistakes. It's absolutely going to guarantee that things continue to be screwed up, that wars continue to happen, that the average person winds up getting hurt, the civilians, and that soldiers continue to kill and be killed. I don't know if that answers your question.
The last question on that is about the dispute of the international waters between these countries.
Well, I don't know what to say. I mean, those boundaries and people claim different miles out, and the United States claims one thing, and the UN recognizes something else, and I don't know. I mean, the question is, what the hell is Britain doing in Iraq at all? What in the hell is the United States doing in Iraq at all? I mean, what in the world are these countries that are thousands of miles away that are trying to control events, are trying to rob the region? I mean, Britain, as I said, has a 130-40-year history of robbing that region, looting that region, and distorting it to the extent that we are suffering the consequences today. And rather rather than trying to deal with this in a way that could put the at least begin the process of peace, if it's even possible by now. I mean, things might be so totally screwed up that that it's impossible, but at least we could give it a try. And it ain't going to happen with wars, that's for sure. It's not going to happen with the Western countries trying to dominate that region. All right, thank you very much. Thanks for the question, Don. Here is, I don't have a name here. Hi, it's Peter and Jolene. What's your name?
My name's John.
John, you're on the air.
I'm in Ann Arbor, and there is a petition going around Ann Arbor, Detroit area to elect Al Gore for president.
I saw that at the demonstration we had against Karl Rove
yesterday. This thing goes way back.
Yeah.
To your question, like a half hour ago. There is a petition that people can sign to get Al Gore to run. And there's also a
Run,
book.
Al, run.
Yeah. Is any idea where we could find that?
What's that?
It's online, isn't it?
Well, I signed it when I went to the Democratic Convention at Cobalt Hall.
Oh.
I think it's online, Al Gore. But I also have one other comment. My friend Marcy Wheeler has wrote a book, The Sympathy of Defeat, for the Scooter Libby trial.
Run that by us one more time.
What's that?
His friend
wrote a book. Marcy,
yeah,
wrote a book. And what's the name of it?
The Sympathy of Deceit. And it's about the Valerie Plame.
Oh, that case.
Yes.
Yeah. That's the one that one of the many criminal acts Karl Rove is responsible for. That's
exactly.
Why we were,
But there's a book out there you should read.
So it's already been published?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep, it's a soft cover.
Yeah.
But anyway, I wanted to let you know that there is a petition to get Al Gore elected.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate that information. And, what do you think, Jolene? I don't follow all the electoral politics that much. But
right.
You think that Al's going to run?
I don't know.
Yeah.
Part of me does.
Yeah.
Part of me doesn't. Part of me thinks that he just wants to continue on this path to heal the earth.
Mm-hmm.
You take your baby to the doctor if it has the fever, but what about the earth?
Our
planet has a fever.
I wonder what the negatives are. I mean, he's certainly on the go. It's not like he doesn't want to do the schedule. I mean,
and you know what? He has loosened up, and people have really, he's endeared himself to a lot more people,
I think. I never cared. I mean, if you think about, when all of a sudden do you have to be, loose? I was looking at this video of Dennis Kucinich that's on my website, and I was thinking, boy, he doesn't look presidential, but I'm thinking, what the hell does that mean?
Yeah, well, yeah. It means
Bush looks presidential.
Yeah, it means wearing a suit and look like you're lying.
Yeah, Bush. Yeah, yeah. Remember we were quoting earlier. The Rocky Anderson, the mayor of Salt Lake City, said, "Let impeachment be the first step towards national reconciliation and towards penance for the outrages committed in our nation's name." And that's what I was talking about. I mean, most of us aren't very good at saying, I really screwed up. I made a terrible mistake. How can I make this good again? Well, that's what we have to do in the Middle East. And you think, we're never going to say we're sorry. Then we can just keep going along like this. Hi, it's WRIF, and you're on the air. You're our last caller. Go ahead. Hey, Dave, you there?
Yeah, I'm sorry.
No, I'm sorry. I had your name up here. I should have said it. Go ahead. You're
okay, I just want to say, first off, Peter, I've been listening to you for years and years. You guys are great.
Well, thank you.
And I just want to clear one thing up. A caller you had earlier regarding Brazil, where the ethanol's from, they get all that from sugar cane.
Oh, yeah,
okay.
That's right.
Yeah.
And I know the one caller wasn't sure where that came from or whatnot, but it is all from sugar cane. Regardless what Bush is doing down there, who knows? And then the other thing, I just want to make a point that I live in Livingston County, and all the gas out here at all the stations is a good 15-20% 20 cents more than any neighboring county.
Really?
It's been sort of hushed over, but there's no real explanation as to why. And the one thing, though, is Sitco, going back to our friend Hugo, his Sitcos out here are what I would consider normal price, considering all the other counties around here. And, regarding the guy's politics and all that stuff, the one thing that he is doing and shows that can be done is he does seem to have a fair gas price, at the pumps for the poor man, basically, or the Eddie man.
I don't know, Dave. I always, and I think Jalene does too, we always gas up at Sitco because we figure if we're getting ripped off or $2.50 a gallon, at least the profits aren't going to pay a $400 million retirement fund for the ExxonMobil CEO, and instead it's going back to these what they call misiones, these missions in Caracas that provide food and health care and stuff like that, schools for the poorest. And I think their prices are competitive. I mean, Sitco is run by American Management, and they don't undercut. I mean, they could. I mean, gasoline. I think I said this last week. It's a gasoline in Caracas when I was there. 14 cents a gallon.
Right.
Yeah, and it's cheaper than water.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah. So,
you know, when I go to Sitco, I always like to look around at the people, and I wonder, are they just radical and cool like us? Or are they just stopping and getting gas? Do they
just
know where their gas is? I mean, I want to like talk to everybody.
I think 98% stop and go.
You think so?
Yeah. Dave, thanks for being our last caller. What do you think? No? Ask him.
I don't, well, you know.
Are you, what can you say?
Last time I talked to someone at a gas station, he asked me out for coffee.
Did you go?
Hell no.
Oh, you're married.
Yeah. Well, plus he wasn't my type.
Right. Hey, friends. Thanks a lot. Jalene Jordan, thank you. Al Slayer, thank you for doing all the work you've done tonight.
Absolutely.
Stay tuned for Deepa Fernandez. She's written an incredible book called Targeted, Homeland Security and the Business of Immigration. After that, an interview with the author of the novel, Che. And I'll talk a little about my trip to Cuba a couple of years ago as well. And we'll talk live next week.
This is WRIF.com. We'll be right back.
Blood.
On 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. As I was coming into the radio station to record this interview, came across the news that a bipartisan group of House lawmakers have launched another push for overhauling U.S. immigration laws, and they would introduce a bill to give millions of illegal immigrants a chance to become citizens. That's the lead story for this. Joining me to talk about this and about a brand new book published by Seven Stories Press is Deepa Fernandez. She's the host of Wake Up Call. It's on Pacifica Radio. It's on their station in New York City, WBAI. She has an award-winning radio features. They've aired on the BBC World Service and Public Radio International. Her writing has appeared in the Village Voice, In These Times, and the New York Amsterdam News. Her book is called Targeted, Homeland Security and the Business of Immigration, a foreword by the wonderful historian Howard Zinn. Joining me from New York City is Deepa Fernandez. Deepa, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Peter, it's so good to be with you.
Well, I actually wasn't going to talk, and we will talk a lot about your book, Targeted, but every once in a while we think, well, maybe the immigration concerns and the debates have kind of dropped out of sight, but they're with us continually. What do you make of this new law, and is this something that you would think would begin to solve the problem, if it is a problem?
You know, it's a huge problem, and I think, though I see the problem in a very different way from the way in which it's currently being represented, I do think we have an immigration crisis, and I think the crisis that we have is that our laws as they are currently, and even those, the one you just mentioned that's been introduced into Congress today, is not the solution, that in fact it'll create greater hardship, not just for immigrants and for non-citizens, but for people who live in this country. And there are so many ways in which, and I'm sure we'll have time to go into some of that as we're talking today, Peter, but we need to really take a long, hard look at what goes into our immigration legislation. Take, for example, the bill that was entered today. You know, for people who don't agree that those who are in the country illegally should have a path to citizenship, well, they probably won't like this bill. But for those who believe, like I do, that there should be a path to citizenship for those who currently are here without documents, those who are working very hard. And it's not my statistic, Peter, but the government themselves would tell you that the overwhelming majority of people, and we're talking like high 90s in the percentile, who are here undocumented, are contributing greatly to the economy. It's one of the biggest myths that people who are undocumented are a drain on the economy. In fact, the Texas Comptroller just put out the first and most comprehensive study on exactly how much people who are undocumented are contributing to the Texas economy, and something to the tune of $17 billion, and that factors in what it costs the state in terms of healthcare and education. So when people when you look at the facts and you see that actually people who are undocumented contribute in a great way, and then you look at a piece of legislation like this that says, okay, here's a path to citizenship. Well, we have to look extremely carefully, Peter, at the details. And that's what I've spent the last few years doing, is looking at the details of these immigration legislation, because really very few people will actually benefit from the way it's structured currently. What it does and what it asks of those who are undocumented is very hard to prove. In fact, very few people, I mean, think about it. We've seen these big raids go on around the country.
Sure.
Part of being able to prove that you've been here and been contributing is to go to the person who employed you and say, I need you to sign this form to say that you are my employer. I mean, if we're telling employers that what they're doing is wrong and then we want them to vouch for immigrants, who's going to do that?
Well, of course, so much of the basis of this is that the economy of other countries drives people to the United States. I mean, these are men and women who are probably in some ways the most highly motivated people that are willing to undergo incredible hardships in order to provide for their families and for themselves. And do the majority of people that are here illegally, do they want to become citizens, or do they actually just see this as a temporary manner in which to gain an income?
You know, I think it's a very hard question to answer, because obviously there's no hard and fast data surveying people. And I think the one thing that we have to be careful of is that that we even see a group of, say, the undocumented as one homogenous group, because they're not. As you pointed out, many people are coming here because they've been driven out for economic reasons from their home. And U.S. trade policies, as I document in Targeted, have a lot to do with that. And I don't think we can skirt that issue at all. If we really genuinely care about a solution to immigration, and you know, I've been called a bleeding heart liberal for saying this, but I honestly believe that if people step back and look at why is this person leaving their homeland? Why are they coming here? What do they want to get out of it? And I think you'll find probably, and most of the people who I spoke to are here for economic reasons. They want to work. They're earning money, sending it home. Many people are trying to build a home or trying to save enough money to purchase a small business back in their home country. So no, maybe many people don't want to stay here long term, but the reality is they actually in some ways get locked into a system which keeps them here because they can't go and come. They can't leave the country and go home. They can't set up a relationship with their home country that would be beneficial in both ways. So it's such a complex problem. But as you pointed out, Peter, we absolutely have to look at the root cause of why people are coming mm-hmm. here. So when your original question is, do we have a problem and what do we do about it? We're essentially batting flies if we don't look at the core problem. And so for me, that's not, it's not a law enforcement problem. It's not, let's make the borders more secure. Let's try and look at the reason why people are leaving so that they don't come across the border.
Sure. Well, we used to welcome what we call refugees from communism. These are refugees from capitalism, a capitalism that isn't working south of the border. But also, we always
great
think,
way of putting it. I hadn't thought about that.
Well, also about half of the undocumented people in this country are of Mexican origin, but there's quite a few from Poland, from Ireland, from other parts of the Caribbean, from other parts of Latin America. And yet, when you talk, Deepa Fernandez, about the undocumented contributing to the American economy, I think people are going, what? Come on, they're taking jobs, and how can they possibly be adding to the economy when they're taking away, quote, American jobs?
Well, that's a very simple question to answer, and again, I go back to the Texas Comptroller's report, just because there's been many studies that have been done. You can look at the Thunderbird Business School in Arizona that has actually looked at and calculated the income. Okay, how does that happen? How do people who are undocumented, how do they even pay money? How do they contribute? Well, in multiple ways. First of all, their employers are paying payroll taxes on them. That's money that goes to the government. Secondly, the majority are using Social Security numbers. It might not be their own. They might have procured them so that they can get that job. So they're paying Social Security taxes. They're contributing to Medicaid. Now, Medicaid and Social Security are two things that undocumented immigrants, even documented immigrants, legal permanent residents will never receive. It's almost a gift of money. When we look at Social Security being in such trouble, will we have money to pay people in their retirement? Well, thank God for undocumented immigrants, because they're really helping out the Social Security system. So undocumented immigrants are contributing through taxes that they paid. You can also, that the IRS doesn't care about your status, they just want your money. And you can apply for an ITIN number, and there's a large percentage of undocumented immigrants that have applied for those. And what that means is you can pay taxes just like everybody else. You give that to your employer and you're paying taxes. So federal and state governments are receiving money, and as the Texas Comptroller report shows, they're receiving money from immigrants. Now, the other big thing to consider is sales tax.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody has to pay sales tax. When you buy a cup of coffee, when you go to the grocery store, you're paying sales tax. That is income to the state. So when you have people who are living in your neighborhood, they are contributing. And what we then have to look at is, are they getting the benefits of those who contribute taxes like they do? And the simple answer to that is no, they're not. They're not getting they don't have access to the healthcare system in the same way. They don't have access to the education system in the same way. So in some ways, it really is quite the opposite, that undocumented immigrants are contributing greatly to the economy and actually not using the resources that citizens are using.
My guest is Deepa Fernandez. Her brand-new book from Seven Stories Press is targeted, Homeland Security and the Business of Immigration, which we haven't really gotten to yet. You can go to sevenstories.com. And, Deepa, I forgot to ask you, is there a website other than sevenstories.com that we should tell people about?
I would highly encourage people to visit the website of the radio show that I host here in New York. It's called Wake Up Call. And on a daily basis, we're covering immigration issues. So if you're interested in immigration, wakeupcallradio.org. It's all one word, Wake Up Call Radio. And even today, Peter, on our show, we looked at a story two issues that are breaking here in the New York area. One is that Governor Spitzer is moving very quietly to implement the Real ID Act that passed federally. Now, it's up to states to implement this, and currently there's 27 states that are considering not implementing it because of the way it'll set up a dual justice system, of the way it will really make life not just for undocumented immigrants, but for documented immigrants, legal lawful permanent residents, people who may have lived in this country for 20 years, more than that, for decades, how difficult it'll make life for them. Governor Spitzer, who as a Democrat came to power with a lot of support of people across New York, is very quietly moving to push this through. And then on the flip side, there was a really important story that happened in the Suffolk County Legislature, where we had a large influx from the anti-immigrant movement, and in my book, in the last chapter of Targeted, I show that anti-immigrant movement and Long Island, Farmingville is really a great example. It's not simply just quote unquote anti-immigrant. What it is in fact connected to hate groups, connected to white supremacist groups, and these groups came in to Long Island, to Suffolk County, and they mobilized, they organized, they had a lot of funds, and they lobbied very hard to pass legislation that would make it illegal for workers to stand on a street corner to get work as a day laborer. And it was dubbed the Standing While Latino Bill, that it would make it illegal for you to do that. And in a big victory, actually, considering the strength of the opposition, the Suffolk County Legislature rejected that on Tuesday night. So these are the kinds of issues that we cover. WakeUpCallRadio.org. We've had the SWIFT raids that I'm sure your listeners are aware of that took place, where the government went in and picked people up. In Connecticut, there have been raids happening at various corporate factories that are doing business with producing backpacks for the troops in Iraq. Well, there was a raid of that factory, and we talked to a woman who herself was taken. She was arrested. And a lot of these raids are targeting women. Women are being taken away from their children, from their families. Children are being left by themselves for days on end because no one's realized that their mother never came home.
Well, Deepa, though, the hard-hearted response often to that is, hey, these people are in the country illegal. They're lawbreakers. Why should we have much tender concern for anything other than than that they belong out of here, that they're here in the United States illegally. If the circumstances warrant it, they can be found. They pick them up, send them back.
Well, I think one concrete thing to think about is just think about your day. Start at the beginning of your day and think about what you do in your daily life. Where do you get your breakfast from? Where when you take the bus or the train to get to work and then you stop by the store to pick up a couple of things, those tomatoes that are in your sandwich at lunchtime, who's picking those? The bag that you're probably slinging over your shoulder, who's manufacturing those? You know, even just the fast food restaurant that you might run into to pick up a snack, who's working in the kitchen out the back there? I think every single one of us, and there's actually a great film, A Day Without Immigrants, that really paints this very starkly, that literally if we took out the labor that undocumented immigrants provide to our society, I think each and every one of us, we don't even need to have a humanitarian concern. We could just look at how our lives would be dramatically different. We want we want to live cheaply here in America. There's no two ways about it. You do, I do, everybody does.
Well, and there's labor shortages because of increased enforcement. There's a number of, as far north as like Washington and State and Oregon and in the Midwest, there's farmers who can't get the labor that they want. And we were talking earlier about enforcement at the border and how that doesn't allow people to go back and forth. So you got people that come, and rather than going back, they stay. Hey, just before we go on, Deepa Fernandez, tell me just a little about yourself. You have a Hispanic last name, a South Asian first name. I hear everything from a British Isles accent to even Boston. What's the mix here, if I may ask?
I'm Indian. I was born in India, so that's where the Deepa comes from. The Fernandez is actually it's spelt with an S at the end, so it's Portuguese, the Portuguese priests colonizing in the south of India.
Okay.
And then my parents were immigrants to Australia when I was little. So I was born in India, and I grew up in Sydney. And so the accent that you're hearing is not from Boston.
Okay.
But that's good. I haven't heard that one before.
Okay.
And I myself, when I was 20, I left Australia and I moved to the United States.
Okay. In your book, Targeted, Homeland Security and the Business of Immigration, and let's talk about that subtitle as soon as we finish that. But you say, to Abba John, my gentle and patient grandfather, who lived and died with the fear of being deported from Australia. Mm-hmm. What? Why was he fearful?
I think in some ways it's a very typical immigrant story. My grandparents have 7 children, of whom 5 managed to immigrate to Australia. They're all Australian citizens. Many of their children, so of my grandparents, I think it's 16 grandchildren, 12 of us are Australian citizens. And my grandparents were getting old, and none of their children, they're from Bombay, and all their children moved away, and they were getting old, and they wanted to be around their family as they were aging and have their kids to take care of them. And the Australian government repeatedly denied them visas, and they couldn't live in India by themselves. So when they came on one trip to Australia, they stayed.
Hmm.
And I guess this, for me, Peter, is really where it comes close to home, because my grandparents are not criminals. So when people talk about people who are undocumented, you know, having done something illegal and being criminals, their crime is that they wanted to be near their children, and I think we can all relate to that. And so the Australian government threatened to deport them regularly. It never took the steps to detain them like happens, it's happening now in Australia, but it didn't back then. But like here in the US, they weren't detained, but they would routinely receive very threatening letters. And in fact, they at one point left the country because it was so traumatic to them that they were framed as these criminals and that they were living their life underground, essentially, that they left. And it was a big deal for my family, because we actually went and brought them back.
Huh.
And we brought them back to Australia, and you know, none of my families are criminals. And my grandfather died just wanting to be able to live in peace in one place. And my grandmother is in the process in Australia of legalizing her status, and she's been waiting in the queue for 11 years.
Boy. Deepa Fernandez is my guest on the Peter Werby Show. The book, and we're going to talk about the important subtitle, Targeted, Homeland Security and the Business of Immigration. Now, we think of immigration, the problems revolving around it, having to do with political and social, but this, like so many things in America, including war, turns out to be big business, doesn't it?
I was shocked myself, I have to say. When I started this and I was talking about this idea with a couple of my friends who are investigative journalists, their advice to me was, you know, Deepa, try to set out to prove yourself wrong. And I was like, you know, I just want to look and see, you know, as we hear about all these contracts going out around Iraq, is it the same thing around immigration? Because, like, I come in at the airport and I see these, like, fancy machines that are doing all these kinds of things. So I began to investigate it, and very quickly I was just drowning in material of, well, the Department of Homeland Security, which was created 2 years after 9/11, and there was very little scrutiny of the Department of Homeland Security. What was its goals? What was its mission? Why was it created? You know, presidents just don't come along and create departments. The last department that was created was in 1947. It was the Department of Defense. So what was the... If we're just creating another whole department, there's obviously got to be a strong mandate. The budget's got to be clear. We've got to know what we're doing. And as I began to investigate, I discovered that President Bush created a secret, literally a secret commission to advise him, and that was heads of corporate America was advising him on how to protect the homeland. And
This is the Homeland Security Advisory Council that you talk about in Targeted. That was a secret council made up of what, business leaders?
Business leaders, there's, you know, a couple of academics in there, think tank people, but when you trace all their roots, they're all very cozy with the Bush administration, no bones about it. And they're leaders whose companies don't necessarily have anything to do with Homeland Security, and in fact, worse, Peter, they have a terrible record on Homeland Security. Take Eli Lilly. Eli Lilly used its position. They were under a lot of pressure, being sued by parents around the country for mercury vaccines. And I'm not in a position to pass judgment on whether they were guilty or not. But the fact is, that's where they were at that point. And Eli Lilly slipped into the Homeland Security Act of 2002. Now, DHS wasn't even created then, but Eli Lilly was on this committee to help do the thinking to set it up. The 2002 Homeland Security Act, Eli Lilly slips in a clause that would indemnify it from all lawsuits against mercury poisoning in these vaccines. What does that have to do with Homeland Security, and why should... So it was little things like that that caught my attention, and I began to investigate further. And then
well,
again,
big things. There's Halliburton and Kellogg Brown and Root, our old friends from Iraq.
Absolutely.
Right. What role are they playing in the business of immigration that you talk about?
I think in some ways what I wanted to focus on was not even so much the big corporations like the KBRs and the Bechtels, who are all up in there. Don't be mistaken for a moment. But what I found really interesting, Peter, was that there are so many companies that we all know and are part of our lives. I don't think anyone can really relate to, like, Kellogg Brown and Root being in their life on a daily basis. But if your cell phone company is Sprint, what's Sprint doing enforcing immigration legislation? What do they know about immigration? What about an electronics store? For us here in New York City, one of the big electronics stores, kind of like a Circuit City, is called B&H Audio Video. I would liken it to a Circuit City. So think about going to a store like that and finding out that they're actually making very expensive, tiny digital cameras to sell to the government for Border Patrol to put on their helmets, almost like a helmet cam. But to do that, and there's this distinct relationship with what we're proposing to sell you, and then whether we need immigration legislation to match it. Think of fingerprinting machines. You can't just put fingerprinting machines at all ports of entry. You have to have some kind of legislation that says we now need to fingerprint all incoming foreigners. So there's many different ways, and I go through this in Targeted of following the money, where there's a big profit motive for companies to actually design a system that the government, and I can give you another example of an unmanned drone to protect the border. And this was actually designed by an out-and-out white supremacist who followed the lead of Israeli defense companies, which are the ones that manufacture these unmanned drones. And if you don't know what an unmanned drone is, I didn't, but they're like these tiny little remote control airplanes that you could imagine a kid playing with. And they're used mostly in war zones, like they're used right now in Iraq. They're employed in Iraq. And they're used by the military to fly them over areas to check if there's life. They have these little tiny sensors in them that will detect life. So this white supremacist decided, well, we should use these on the border to protect the border. We can help Border Patrol figure out where the undocumented immigrants are. Now, I'm still baffled at how an unmanned drone would be able to tell whether somebody's documented or not.
Deepa, let me do this. This is my fault. We should have put aside about an hour and a half for this rather than the time we have. We're about less than 60 seconds away. In your book, Targeted, Homeland Security and the Business of Immigration, solutions in 45 seconds. I'm glad you didn't ask me that.
I would say everybody to please go away and read the legislation that is pending right now. Educate yourself, read it, because there will be things in there that will make your skin crawl. I guarantee it. I've done that for the last few pieces of legislation, and there's really shocking things in there. And then let's really, as a country, examine the root causes of why people are coming here before we launch into solutions. Let's educate ourselves.
Well, thank you so much. Tom Hayden, former Detroiter and former California delegate to the U.S.-Mexico Border Commission, says immigrants are dying for jobs. That's the bottom line few recognize, like Deepa Fernandez. She portrays not only the human dimension, but how an immigrant industrial complex profits at all our expense. So don't be fooled, people. It's too easy. Deepa Fernandez, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werbe Show. Oh, yeah, I should give the websites once again. WakeUpCallRadio.org. You can go to my website. I'll have a link to that site as well. Thank you for joining me on the Peter Werbe Show.
Thank you, Peter.
Here we'll be. This is WRIM.com.
101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. A pleasure to be with you. Some of you are going to be hearing this for the first time. I just came back from a trip to the Republic of Cuba. And this was on an approved journalist trip to find out information, and primarily for these radio broadcasts. So much is said about Cuba from Washington. It's been a thorn in the side of any number of administrations since 1958. And I thought I'd go take a look for myself. That's not what this show is about. It's just kind of the synchronicity of it all, because joining me is Jay Cantor. Jay Cantor has reissued his novel, The Death of Che Guevara. Jay Cantor is the author of two other novels, Great Neck and Crazy Cat. He also has two books of essays, The Space Between Literature and Politics, and one with a terrific title, On Giving Birth to One's Own Mother. He's a MacArthur Prize Fellow, and he teaches at Tufts University. We're reaching him in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where he lives. Jay Cantor, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you.
I didn't tell you that little piece of news before we started, did I?
No.
No.
Your news is more up to date than mine.
Well, yes, and that, and I kept thinking when I saw this, when I received this from Vintage, the publisher,
mm-hmm.
I said, "Boy, why does this sound familiar? The Death of Che Guevara." I said, well, it's a new novel by Jay Cantor. It's actually not a new novel at all, is it? It's a reissue. Tell us a little about its history.
The book began for me in 68 when I was in college. I was very active working in the anti-war movement then, and I saw a picture, but I can't say, you know, I was very active in working in the anti-war movement. I was trying to understand the causes of the war in Vietnam and the way out of it, but I can't say that my politics, you know, I was 19 years old, and I thought I knew a lot, and at the same time, I think I knew that I knew next to nothing, but I saw a picture of Che Guevara's corpse in Bolivia, a famous picture of him, and it was published along with the diaries of the Bolivian campaign, the campaign in which he was captured and met his death, executed actually at the orders of the Central Intelligence Agency.
Maybe you, let me just stop you one second. All of a sudden, I'm almost fearful that...
Who is this Che Guevara?
Yeah, Che Guevara, the Cuban revolutionary, Fidel Castro's close comrade in arms, who decides he just doesn't want to be a bureaucrat in Cuba. In the 60s, he leaves for Bolivia to lead a revolutionary movement. He's captured. He's executed. And you described that. Yeah, so I'm sorry. Go ahead. It was actually, remiss.
That's dead on.
He was
an Argentinian doctor who met Castro, who had a completely ridiculous idea that they would take a boat from Mexico with a small handful of men and that they would make a revolution in Cuba. And he believed him and joined him, and most of them died within the first days that the boat landed, but they did indeed make the revolution that's been a thorn in the side of many administrations.
Mm-hmm.
And he not only didn't want to be a bureaucrat, he thought that if there weren't other countries, particularly in Latin America, following the same socialist path, that the Cuban Revolution would be starved and die.
Yeah, and the death of Che Guevara, the title of your novel, Jay Cantor, is set it's from 1928 to 1967, the years of Ernesto Che Guevara's life and death. So, again, you were telling me the history, your college.
Yeah, you were saying, how did it come about? I was looking at a picture of his corpse, and I couldn't say why. It was emaciated. He'd been starving in Cuba. He suffered from starving in Bolivia. Had gotten no response from the peasants there, and had been captured because of that. He suffered from terrible asthma. His body was emaciated when he was caught, and his chest quite wrecked from the asthma and riddled with bullets. And the picture moved me, and that began the research that led to the book.
Mm-hmm.
I think I felt also that through learning about Guevara, I would learn not only about the Cuban Revolution, but something about how the United States looked to the rest of the world.
Well, it originally appeared in hardcover.
Right.
And that was in 1983, yet it's copyrighted in 1977. So what happened to it in the...
That I don't understand. Oh, you know why that is? It's because parts appeared in magazines.
Oh, I see.
I started in 67, I think parts... And I kept having to rewrite. The more that I learned about politics and the more that as history and as the world turned and I realized that everything that I thought was wrong repeatedly, I kept having to rewrite. And the 77 is because parts of it appeared in magazines in 77. The whole manuscript was done in 82, and it was published in 83.
Okay.
And it came out in paper a few years after that, then went out of print and has come back into paperback now.
Why suddenly has it come back? Who initiated that?
Actually, that has more to do with the vagaries of publishing. The book I wrote, it stayed in print, and then I wrote a book called Crazy Cat, which is about a cat who used to work in a comic strip, a very different kind of book.
Right.
And it came out in 88, and then when... and came out again in paper, and then it went out of print. And then my next book, Great Neck, which is about the anti-war movement and the civil rights movement in America in the 60s and 70s, took me some 15 years to write. And it's because that book was published that all of the books came back into print.
Okay, well, let's look at that. Well, one more question about the printing history. You said as you began rewriting, as you began learning more and more, is there a difference in the text between 1983 and 2005?
No.
No.
The text, I've given the opportunity, I probably would rewrite it again. But finally, I learned something about writing a novel, and you have to write a novel not... A novel isn't a series of conclusions. A novel is a series of questions about the world. And as I learned that and began to turn this book into a series of questions more than a... questions are open-ended and don't require quite so much rewriting.
Right. Well, and I want to ask you about some of those questions, but maybe a way... to address some of them. One of the reasons that I brought up my recent trip to the island of Cuba was that it is absolutely startling, the Che iconography that exists there. It's everywhere. There's no big posters of Fidel or Raul Castro or anybody, but Che is literally everywhere. You go on a bus and there's little stickers of Che. There's billboards in beautiful preserved colonial towns like Cienfuegos. And the main square, instead of having a billboard for toothpaste that says, the ideas of Che live, they will live forever. And Jean-Paul Sartre, the existentialist philosopher, said that he was the most complete human being of our age. Wow, that's...
okay. I don't know the most complete, but I would say this. He rang with one truth, that it was right to rebel, that the conditions under which the great mass of humanity lived were intolerable, that a solution had to be found, and that one had to pursue that solution wherever it took one, in his case, to the jungle in Bolivia. And he lived that. He lived it uncompromisingly. And so his life rings with a single note. Fidel's life, Raul's life, or the life of somebody, or people trying to build a nation, people who have made compromises along the way, bureaucrats, as you say, Che's life has the purity of striking exactly one note and striking it in tune and purely.
Hmm. And the fact that his life was cut short, of course.
That may be why.
Yeah, well, I was going to say that it ends on a tragic and romantic note, and I don't say that in a disparaging or cynical way.
I think
either.
It's very likely. It's hard to imagine. I think something about the singularity of the man, singular in the sense that his life makes one statement, is... It's hard to imagine it continuing. Had they won in Bolivia, but before they were in Bolivia, one should say, he went to the Congo to try to make a revolution there.
Mm-hmm.
That failed miserably. He then went to Bolivia. If he'd succeeded in Bolivia, there's every reason to imagine he would have gone someplace else until he died. He would have gone on. On his quest, as he understood it, it's hard to imagine him as an old man watching his life on a TV movie about his life.
I was thinking that I'm sure have seen Motorcycle Diaries, right?
I have.
And then his partner on his motorcycle trip, who's a man probably in his mid-80s now.
Yeah.
I was thinking that, how unusual that would have been if he...
Right.
I think
Alberto Granados, who wrote really one of the most wonderful books about Guevara, called My Friend Che, about those years... very direct and honest portrait about a man who transformed Granados' life. You know, Granados leaves with him and ends up after staying in Cuba to help build the medical system in Cuba. And I think Granados somewhere says that. You can't imagine Che old. He would have kept going. And he would have died as he died.
Talk to us a little, if you would, about the iconography, the fact that these images of Che, certainly they prevail in Cuba with a very strong social and political message that speaks to the Cuban people right there. But you go to, like, the fanciest boutiques now. In fact, there's been an uptick in interest in that. What do you make of that? Why?
Well, I think the problem is, for him, the words "it's right to rebel," which I think is the slogan that begins the Cultural Revolution in China, they had a very particular meaning. It was right to work against imperialism. As you say, it had a political meaning for him. But it's also a very open-ended idea, rebellion. Bart Simpson rebels. I think there's a famous cartoon of Che Guevara wearing a Bart Simpson T-shirt. And there's a way in which... There's a famous movie of Marlon Brando called The Wild One, where he plays a guy on a part of a motorcycle gang, and they say to him, "Oh, why are you so angry? What are you rebelling against?" And Brando says, "What do you got?" And there's something about being young. It's a period where you feel like you want to rebel against your own body, and you want to rebel against your teachers at school and the principal, and youth culture and the people who sell youth culture always want to tap into that and turn it into a product for you to buy. And Che has that very open-ended quality of it's right to rebel. Well, it's right to rebel against your principle. It's right to rebel against. But he had a very specific meaning in mind for that. And in Cuba and throughout Latin America, is his life still has that meaning.
Now, and a meaning that we see both from your book, The Death of Che Guevara, Che Cantor, and for conditions still throughout Latin America,
right,
that it's a life and death issue. And but what's being sold here are these images of rebellion. So I don't know whether that's a positive or a negative.
No, it's not. I mean, I think if the results are in. You take anything and you make it abstract and distant enough like that so that rebellion can mean anything, eventually it will mean nothing.
Or it can mean rebellion means wearing a symbol of rebellion.
Rebellion, right. You don't even have to rebel against your teacher. You just have to rebel something that says, f*** the teacher.
Yeah.
Can I say that?
I know, but let's move on.
Okay. All right. Or something that...
Yeah, right.
Substitute a word, please. Whatever. And, and at that point it becomes saleable and empty.
Well, let me ask you some about the structure of this book. It's quite detailed. One would almost over 500 pages. And how does one, as a novelist, particularly as a fairly young one, since the genesis of this was in the
starting young
in the late 60s,
getting gray haired as I wrote.
Okay. Yeah. How do you find out so much information? I mean, how much of it is out of the mind of Che Cantor? How much of it his historical research?
At the beginning of Moby Dick, Melville says, I swam through libraries. I went where I could, but there's a lot of research. There's an enormous amount of research in the book. And there's an enormous amount of research so that when I imagined something, I tried to make it fit seamlessly with what was real.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give you an example of that, which I find odd and almost troubling. One of the things that the book is about is how the stories that we tell about history, which turn into myths and fiction, like my book, move people to take action, and so they make history. That many of the people are moved by stories, but they make real history. So I wanted to dramatize. Che was a doctor, and unlike most doctors, he took away a violent revolution, and I wanted to dramatize that in his life. So I wanted to contrast him with a great anti-imperialist figure, Mahatma Gandhi, who had taken a nonviolent path.
Right.
And in the book, I make Guevara a follower of Gandhi. I was doing a radio interview like this recently, and I heard two experts on Guevara, one who teaches literature at Barnard College, one who works, actually a film reviewer for the Village Voice, and they both spoke of Guevara's Gandhian, his Gandhi period. His Gandhi period exists only in my novel. And I didn't know what to say. I'd written a book about how fiction makes history, and it was changing history.
Were there some art forgers who created a Picasso period?
Yeah,
Picasso
something
kept saying,
like that.
He kept saying, I never painted these.
But having said that, it was true to the. I think the reason they believed it was true to the internal life of Guevara. He was a person who wanted to help people, who was moved, as he said, by great feelings of love, and yet, eventually moved towards violence as the way to do that. And that's an enormously hard, brutal, difficult conflict within a person. And you can give the name Gandhi to one half of it, or you can give the name, as Guevara did, of love to one half of it. But he thought that love meant picking up the gun.
The book is The Death of Che Guevara. It's a novel written by Che Cantor, reissued from its 1983 hardback edition. It's now in paper by Vintage. You're listening to the Peter Werby Show. You can link on to this, by the way, to the Vintage site that describes the book by going to peterwerby.com. There's still something, Che Cantor, nagging at me because...
Yeah, nagging. Now you're going to nag at me. Right?
Yeah, sure.
Go ahead.
That the larger in life nature of this man who helped make a revolution in a pretty small country that was this oppressive dictatorship supported by the United States, overrun by American mafia and American corporations. So I mean that's worthy of telling. But the fact when it even struck me again when you were talking about these academics who are Che experts. That this is an enormous figure, and you've hinted, or even spoke a little to this because I've kind of asked the question before, but it's something that there's something here.
I think you have to look again. He, the other thing to say is once they made the revolution, Guevara became Minister of Finance in Cuba. He was the architect, probably the chief architect of the Cuban economy with its some successes and with enormous amounts of failures. And some of those failures belonged to him. And they were this. He really thought that people would, could, and should work out of love of the collective, out of love for other people, not for profit in any way. Not for personal gain in any way. And he lived his life according to that, and he thought that others would live their lives in that way.
He actually wanted to create, as he said, a socialist man, a different prototype of
what
human
it meant
interaction.
To be a human being.
Yeah.
A human being, as I say, who was moved for love of others and love of the work that they could do for others. That kind of purity was enacted in his life. He was not a person who was looking to get a summer house as Minister of Finance. He was singular in always trying to understand what it would mean to embody that ideal in the world and to live it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something compelling about that. It's, as I say, there are enormous numbers of mistakes that need to be put in on his debit sheet, but there is something compelling about somebody who lives their life according to what they believe in and is ever trying to see what it would mean, despite the risks, to continue to live their life in that way.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've ever heard the joke, and I won't even try it in Spanish, but essentially the Fidel was, and this is all apocryphal, but said to his inner circle, which of you is the best economista, the best economist? And Chase says, I will. And he says, all right, so you're the Minister of Finance. And after, he said, what do you know about the economy? So what are you talking about? He said, I asked who was the best economista. He said, oh, I thought you said comunista.
Well, yes.
But that leads me.
You would have thought that the two came together.
Yes, that leads me to the question, though, that that in the West, well, let me just say in the United States, particularly, that Che, although a symbol of rebellion, in reality, along with Fidel, is thought of as someone that presided over a very harsh totalitarian society, and that what you were ascribing as these egalitarian and idealistic ways, in fact, once it was put into practice, was a bureaucratic police state.
There are certainly, how far one wants to take that, I can't say, but any account of Guevara's life that left that out would be untrue.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you a good thing about my book. Somewhere on the internet in one of the sites devoted to Guevara, they said, people who think Guevara is a saint hate this book. People who think he's a devil hate this book, my book. So I think he got it about right.
There you go. On the back cover of The Death of Che Guevara, it says a brilliant, what the hell is that word, exegesis? Is that
yeah.
Right? Okay.
That is, I don't know, actually, I don't know the back cover, but that is a word.
Okay. It's a brilliant exegesis, which I think means a good statement or expression of the psychology of radical activism. Now, one of the things I was thinking of is that what you said right at the beginning, Jay Cantor, and that is that that they carry, this is the man of La Mancha. I mean, he carried out the impossible dream. These guys get in this boat, they invade this country that's supported by the United States, and they actually overthrow it. Is that part of the appeal to the left?
Oh,
that, huh?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah?
I mean, yes. Yes, I'm sorry. I don't know what to say except yes. Certainly, that's part of the appeal.
Well, is there
a
more?
A certain amount of, there's a statement of the Marxist writer Gramsci that the world world requires pessimism of the intellect and optimism of the will. And that can easily shade over into Don Quixote.
Yeah.
Optimism of the will. I mean, to be a leftist at this moment in the United States, you would have to be nuts.
Well,
I take it that you are, Peter.
Well, I always say I'm so far left, I fell off the spectrum.
Yeah, right.
But so I'm not sure. Well, part of the problem with saying if you're anything is that what does that conjure up? I mean, if you say you're a leftist, does that conjure up Stalin to people? Or does it conjure up? I'm thinking somebody who we would all agree on is pretty good. Martin Luther King. That people can. I don't know. Those are questions that are so frequently manipulated by the mass media to keep us from thinking critically.
True and true.
Well, we only have a couple minutes left, and obviously, I'm always thinking, man.
Yeah, I should say this. He's not the Guevara part of the effort of the probably the first biography that I had to work with was, I'm sure, funded by the Central Intelligence Agency. And published by Stein and Day. They used to do some of their publishing. And it was an attempt to turn Guevara into Stalin. That's not true. He was responsible for the execution of people, but he was not a builder of gulags. But neither was he Martin Luther King.
Mm-hmm.
He was a person who said, he said two things which are very famous. One is a revolutionary... at the risk of being ridiculous, let me say a revolutionary is guided by great feelings of love. I don't think it's ridiculous, but I can understand what people might think. But he's also a person who said, in pursuit of that vocation, somewhat many years after that, he said, we have to become cold, violent, selective killing machines.
Wow. I like the first one better.
Yeah. But and that's a very chilling thing to say. And both of those are parts of Guevara. And the question that he asks any of us is, Latin America, as you say, continues to suffer, and to suffer enormously, as does much of the world. If you're guided by great feelings of love, what is your alternative to violence?
Mm-hmm.
Guevara is standing four square for one position, that your love will... If you really want to enact that love in the world, it will involve violence. If you reject that, then you still have to answer the question, how will you enact that love? What will your action be instead? He wasn't Martin Luther King, and I find King a very attractive figure. But he was up against something maybe even tougher than what King was up against, I can't say.
Sure.
Perhaps so. What's our answer then? Because... if you take him out of the Bart Simpson category, that's the question he's asking.
I think so. Well, we're out of time, and I guess I would say that we should, particularly in this period in the world's history and the history of the United States, that we all ought to be guided by feelings of love and the goal to make it real in the world.
Right.
How we bring it out and bring it about is another thing entirely.
And as you decide that and you think about it, one of the people you'll be arguing with is Che Guevara.
All right.
I will be arguing with.
The Boston Globe says, a brave mammoth fiction, shrewd and romantic in conception, dazzling and postmodernist in construction, one is left with a pan-American legend that Jay Cantor has reworked into a passionate haunting. Thank you so much for being with me on the Peter Ward.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
search for your demigod. You fake with the things you keep.